Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. We have a great program for you tonight. We have Dr. Melva Ketchum coming on the program. She is a highly accomplished DNA scientist. She's been doing research in this area for many years. She has released some information that evidently her peers don't want to hear. And that's why she's here on X Squared Radio tonight, and we're glad you're going to join us. We want you to be part of the program. Our phone number anywhere in North America is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Please try to call with pertinent questions. It helps us move the program along. If you're not in North America, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-413-9537. That's 530-413-9537. And don't forget about our conference line, 805-399-1000. You dial 796-608-pound, and you can listen on your cell phone while you're walking around with that informed smile on your face. The solar wind tonight is 323 kilometers per second, and the proton count is up to 3.8. There are four active sunspot clusters on the sun today, but they are headed over the limb, not to worry. With the departure of massive sunspot 1678, solar activity has returned to low levels. NOAA forecasters estimate a 5% chance of an M-class solar flare and a scant 1% chance of X flares during the next 24 hours. Now, you might think this is good, and sometimes we do too, because massive flares cause geomagnetic storms that can play havoc with Earth's magnetism and the sensitive electronics we have here on this planet at this time. But without flaring, many heliophysicists believe that the atmosphere around Earth will continue to collapse. It is collapsing at a rate in excess of what any atmospheric scientists are expecting. As it turns out, solar activity, like solar flares, helps build the atmosphere of Earth. Excuse me. I got Dr. Melba Ketchum coming on the program tonight. You might have heard of her. She is making a huge splash in DNA physics right now. On November 24th, she released a paper. A team of scientists can verify that their five-year-long DNA study, currently under peer review, confirms the existence of a novel hominin hybrid species, commonly called Bigfoot or Sasquatch, living in North America. Now, we have covered Bigfoot, Sasquatch a couple times on this program from explorers, Joan Ocean and one other. And, you know, it was a little bit out there, a little bit telepathic, but this is the first time we've had hard DNA evidence from a DNA researching team. And I mean, they did extensive DNA sequencing that suggests that the legendary Sasquatch is a human relative that arose approximately 15,000 years ago as a hybrid cross of modern Homo sapiens with an unknown primate species. Now, you know, and I know, that's just not possible the normal way, and that's what we're going to discuss tonight with Dr. Ketchum. Don't miss it. She's going to be on in about 15 minutes. Now, I had somebody send me a great story, and I wanted to share it with you as we begin this program, because my producer and I both know this world is getting really crazy, more crazy than normal. And it's getting crazy because we kind of feel like we're in a taxi and the meter's running and we can't reach the wheel and we can't tell the taxi driver where to go. So he's just driving where the heck he wants to. We feel like society's out of control. You feel like government's out of control. You feel like you have no will in your life. Well, I wanted to share something with you. It's a story by Jeff Hayden. He says, some people get more done than others, a lot more. Sure, they work hard, and they work smart, but they possess other qualities that make a major impact on their performance. They do the work in spite of disapproval, of ridicule. Work too hard, strive too hard, appear to be too ambitious, try to stand out from the crowd. It's a lot easier and much more comfortable to reel it in, to ensure you fit in. Pleasing the crowd is something remarkably productive people don't worry about. Well, they may think about it, but then they keep pushing on. They hear the criticism, they take the pot shots, they endure the laughter or derision or even hostility, and they keep on measuring themselves and their efforts by their own standards. And in the process, they achieve what they want to achieve. They see fear the same way other people view lunch. One of my clients is an outstanding and outstandingly successful comic. Audiences love him. He's crazy good. Yet he still has panic attacks before he walks on stage. He knows he'll melt down, sweat through his shirt, feel sick to his stomach, and all the rest. It's just the way he is. So just before he goes on stage, he takes a quick shower, puts on fresh clothes, drinks a bottle of water, jumps up and down, does a little shadow boxing, and out he goes. Oh, he's still scared. He knows he'll always be scared. He accepts it as part of the process. Pre-show fear is like lunch. It's going to happen. Anyone hoping to achieve great things gets nervous. Anyone trying to achieve great things gets scared. Productive people aren't braver than others. They just find the strength to keep moving forward. They realize fear is paralyzing, while action creates confidence and self-assurance. They can still do their best on their worst day. Norman Mailer said, being a real writer means being able to do the work on a bad day. Remarkably successful people don't make excuses. They forge ahead, because they know establishing great habits takes considerable time and effort. They know how easy it is to instantly create a bad habit by giving in, even just this one time. They see creativity as the result of effort, not inspiration. Most people wait for an idea. Most people think creativity happens. They expect the divine muse will someday show them a new way, a new approach, a new concept, and they wait, and they wait, and wait. Occasionally, great ideas do come to people. Mostly, though, creativity is the result of effort, toiling, striving, refining, testing, experimenting. The work itself results in inspiration. Remarkably productive people don't wait for ideas. They don't wait for inspiration. They know that big ideas most often come from people who do, not from people who dream. They see help as essential, not weakness. Pretend you travel to an unfamiliar country, you know, only a few words of the language and you're lost and a little scared. Would you ask for help? Of course you would. No one knows everything. No one is great at everything. Productive people soldier on and hope effort will overcome a lack of knowledge or skill. And it does, but only to a point. Remarkably productive people also ask for help. They know asking for help is a sign of strength and the key to achieving more. They start. At times, you will lack motivation and self-discipline. At times, you'll be easily distracted. At times, you'll fear failure or success. Procrastination is part of what makes people human. It's not possible to completely overcome any of those shortcomings. Wanting to put off a difficult task is normal. Avoiding a challenge is normal. But think about a time you put off a task, finally got started, and then once into it thought, I don't know why I kept putting this off. It's going really well. And it didn't turn out to be nearly as hard as I imagined. It never is. Highly productive people try not to think about the pain they'll feel in the beginning. They focus on how good they'll feel once they're engaged and involved. And they get started. And then they don't stop. Unless there's a really, really good reason not to finish, which, of course, there almost never is. By the way, before we bring Dr. Melba Ketchum on the program, the now world-renowned DNA physicist, or actually researcher, I want to read a news story to you, because we always talk about how science fiction... hang on just 1 second while I write a note. In Star Trek, you know, we often make fun of transparent aluminum. Sometimes we're getting ready to build something, and we'll use transparent aluminum. Well, Star Trek technical manuals indicate that transparent aluminum is used in various fittings in starships. You remember the episode where they were building the transparent aluminum aquarium to bring two humpback whales back to the past, or to the future, actually. Well, aluminum oxynitride is a form of ceramic whose properties are similar to those of the fictional substance seen in Star Trek. It was patented in 1980 and has military applications as bullet-resistant armor, but is too expensive for widespread use. However, transparent aluminum became another Star Trek fiction turned reality when it was created as a new state of matter by a team of scientists in 2009. A laser pulse removed an electron from every atom without disrupting the crystalline structure. Imagine that. A group of scientists led by Ralph Rolsberger at Deutsches Elektronen-Synchrotron, Hamburg, Germany, succeeded in turning metal transparent during research in 2012 to create quantum computers. And there you go. All right. We have Dr. Melba Ketchum coming on the program. I have to tell you, I am vastly impressed. Anytime we bring a great scientist on the program, we interview scientists, authors, mostly scientists that write things, but occasionally we find a scientist, a legitimate one, that's done work that has been not peer accepted, even though the work is very scientific and has a lot of legitimate data to back it up. Her study was conducted by a team of experts in genetics, forensics, imaging, and pathology. She's from Nacogdoches, Texas. In response to recent interest in the study, Dr. Ketchum can confirm that her team has sequenced three, not one, but three complete Sasquatch nuclear genomes and determined the species is a human hybrid. So here to join me is Dr. Melba Ketchum. Welcome to the program. How are you? I'm waiting for her to patch in.
Can you hear me?
Yes, there we go. How are you, Dr. Ketchum?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Now, would you like to be called Dr. Ketchum or Melba? Or?
It doesn't matter.
Okay, well, we'll just go with Dr. Ketchum. It's catchy. I don't know if you know much about X Squared Radio. This is kind of where coast-to-coast listeners go once they get tired of all the woo-woo stuff. We try to get into more of the hard science here, but we discuss it in a way that's entertaining. Listeners from all over the world tune in, some live, most by archive to listen to what's going on. I've listened to a couple of your other interviews on other programs, and I have to say I'm mighty impressed. I love good science. How did you get involved into DNA research? That's kind of a budding science. It's been around for, what, 15, 18 years, really hard?
Oh, it's longer than that. I got started in this field back in 1985 My degree is in veterinary medicine, but I was practicing and became allergic to some of my patients, so I had to change fields.
I hate when that happens. It happens.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
People get sensitized to monomers and solvents, and they have to change fields even though they love what they're doing. But I'm glad you were able to find a related field. My brother was chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins for almost 20 years, and his building was dedicated to mapping the human genome.
Right.
It's been, you know, a very aggressive program, but we made some remarkable discoveries that did not line up with what our predictions were. Isn't that right?
Yes. There's been a lot of things that we didn't really expect with this. And by the way, I need to make one correction. We did pass peer review.
Oh, great.
So just not, we had to bring the peer reviews with us into this journal.
Excellent. I don't know if a lot of people listen to this program don't understand how important peer review is. If you're going to publish a paper, you want it to get into a major journal, it has to be peer reviewed. Namely, for all intents and purposes, the high priests of science have to kind of put their blessing on it before they'll allow it to be published. And it usually means it can't embarrass them too badly. Science is moving pretty fast, don't you think?
Science is moving very fast. The problem being with established science is that they really have a bias toward our subject matter. It's not. We've had very little critique of the actual manuscript itself, or the techniques, or anything in it. The critique is that they just don't believe that we can say that Sasquatch actually is real and it exists, and therefore they're trying to find everything they can to fault our data, which we now have it out being looked at by independent scientists with more fame attached to them than I have. And they should come up with the same results as the University of Texas did on our genome, and we'll be vindicated at that point for sure. It won't matter where it's been or who's looked at it.
Well, that's the remarkable thing, is that once you get your data in place, you have the statistics to back up any error that might be in the measurements. Because you're going someplace where no one's ever gone before. It's not like you have, you know, 10,000 human subjects and you've narrowed down the traits for different ethnicities or hair color or, you know, the curvature of fruit fly wings. This is pretty rare. You only have a few specimens, and yet the DNA is so remarkably different than human or primate DNA. It's a hybrid.
That's what it certainly appears to be. There would have to be some type of mitigating circumstances to allow the amount of mutation to bring it to where it is in such a short period of time. So it really, the only real option here is hybrid, we do believe, unless there's some type of circumstance that we're not seeing as far as very, very fast mutation, extreme environmental pressure or something to make the, you know, them go from a regular human to you know, where they are right now in less than 13,000 years, which is one of our younger haplotypes on the mitochondrial DNA.
Well, I would suppose, I mean, is that the case that you made, that there was some sort of natural selection, some extreme environmental pressures that made mutations that would give them a survivability advantage in that environment to propagate?
That's one of the theories that could be there. But like I say, it's been such a short time that Sasquatch as a species has existed, it really appears more that they're a hybrid just due to the short period of time.
Well, I mean, normally when people think of hybrid, you know, of course we have all the brain-eating alien movies out now, but we think of taking two species and letting them breed together, like we do a donkey and a horse to get a mule.
And that's what we really feel has happened, maybe with a little less difference than a horse and a donkey, because they have different chromosome numbers.
Exactly. And the other thing is that the two species, although genetically similar, you're right, have, you know, vastly different gene pairs. What's the difference between the number of gene pairs in a primate and the number of gene pairs in a human?
Well, we haven't gotten to the bottom of all of that. We had to just, with this first manuscript, all we did was align about, you know, a little less than 3 million bases of what that aligned with human chromosome 11 in order to prove that we did indeed have a species outside of regular human, outside of known apes and known primates of other origins. But really the idea of hybridization is not that unusual anyway, because if you've kept up with any of the papers on Neanderthal and the Denisovan individual, you'll find that even though they may be extinct per se, some of their DNA is still found today in modern humans, with the majority of the Neanderthal contribution, which is around 3%, give or take, in Caucasian individuals. And the Denisovan individual contributed up to 5% of the genes in the Southeast Asian peoples, especially those in around New Guinea.
Interesting.
So this is like a hybrid, but kind of in reverse, but in a shorter time frame.
Exactly. And my familiarity with a hybrid, they're normally not fertile. Depending on, you know, if you could take a Ginny or a Jack, that's where they use the mare or the stallion to create the mule. The mule cannot procreate. Mules cannot mate.
Oddly enough, there's a few cases where they did. It's rare.
Life always finds a way, doesn't it?
There was a mule at Cornell that actually had a foal, among others. So,
wow.
It has happened, but it's just rare. But then again, once again, you had different chromosome numbers. We don't know. We haven't had a live group of cells in order to do what we call a karyotype, to count the chromosomes in the Sasquatch. Mm-hmm. But, you know, chances are much closer to have a viable offspring if you have, you know, same chromosome number. So that could be. We just don't know yet because of we haven't got a karyotype on it. The other thing about it, once again, is that last Denisova paper that came out in Science, they actually said that most of the crosses were Denisovan male on human female, which is the same thing we're seeing here, where it's the unknown progenitor hybridizing with human females. So, once again, there's already a precedent out there. It's just that, one, Sasquatch is alive today, and two, there's been enough stories, myths, et cetera, attached to it, that most scientists that, you know, don't live out in a rural area or anything and get out amongst people that live where they can see the Sasquatch people, they just really have, and you see all the monster shows on TV and what have you that make them out to be monsters, and they think it's just not true and won't even entertain the idea that there could be Sasquatch out there.
Well, one of my listeners has just written me and wants to know when you first observed your first sample. Did someone bring you a tuft of hair, or how did you make your first sample?
Well, I mean, we do species identification in our laboratory, and so we've had samples coming in that were alleged Sasquatch since 1995. We get, you know, one, maybe two a year for somebody would send it in, but they always had turned out to be just regular animals that we, you know, are well documented. Up until about 5 years ago, when we got a sample from a TV show called Destination Truth that was allegedly from a Yeti, actually there were two samples allegedly from Yetis, and then there was another group, North American Bigfoot Search, Dave Pilates' group. He sent some hair samples in at the same time that came via eyewitness reports. And so when we tested these samples, there was something a little bit unusual about them. There wasn't very much DNA on these samples. So, you know, we didn't have enough to really prove anything. But we had something that acted a little bit different. And so that piqued my interest. Curiosity killed the cat, so to speak. And when Destination Truth aired, we ended up with, you know, a lot of people wanting to send samples.
When you say very little DNA, you mean there were some cells on there besides hair? It was some skin cells or saliva or something like
that? Yeah, so roots, hair roots.
Okay.
You know, if you pluck out a hair, it's going to have a little bulb of tissue on the end of it.
Uh-huh.
That's what will give you more DNA. It'll give you better DNA and what have you.
Now, was this nuclear DNA or mitochondrial DNA? Or?
Well, if you're it's nuclear and mitochondrial DNA on a hair root, because it's going to have, you know, intact cells, which, you know, have a nucleus, which is nuclear DNA. And, of course, the cytoplasm of the cells has mitochondrial DNA. So where there's one, there's the other. Unless you're further down into hair shafts where you start losing the nuclear DNA.
Now this was your first sample. You say it piqued your curiosity. What did you do then? Did you say, we need more samples? Where did you find this? Did you make any observations of your own, or did any of your team?
Well, of course we did. We, you know, once we got past these original couple of hairs that came in, we actually, North American Bigfoot sent some more samples in, and they were, you know, very various ones. None of them had very much DNA, because there would be just one or two hairs, and, you know, one or two may have roots or may not. And, you know, to do what we needed to do, we really needed a little more DNA than what we were getting. So, you know, it was slow going at first.
So did you or any of your team go into the field, or did you just rely on trappers or hunters or campers to bring in samples?
We relied on mostly it was people that had some experience that were interested in the subject matter, and they actually were out seeking DNA samples, seeking hair samples, seeking anything they could find that might lead to you know, a good DNA sample. We even have one project in the study, the Erickson Project, that they had a PhD in wildlife biology that was overseeing their program, and they used food traps, and they would, you know, they were all handled in a sterile manner. It was done in a very scientific way, and it was done at a habituation site where, you know, the Bigfoot, the Sasquatch, stayed close around because the lady at the house would feed them every day. And he has remarkable footage, of which he shared a small clip with us for the manuscript. And, you know, so it was well documented. The one that's in the video clip is one that we have the DNA from in the study. So, I mean, it's not just fly-by-night, oh, gee, I found some hair on, you know, on a post. There's, you know, there's a couple of those kind of samples, but most of them were, you know, gathered on with the intent of getting DNA from the Sasquatch.
Now, were these like single animals, or were these communities of animals? I hesitate to call them animals because they're...
No, they're people. They're a type of people.
Yeah.
They're different from us, but they're still a type of people.
I would think so.
That's why they can outwit people enough to stay quite hidden.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of reclusive animals, bears and even wolves and, of course, deer. There's a lot of deer in the forest, but they can hear you a long time before you can hear them. Still, we see a lot of them coming down the mountain on the hoods of pickup trucks. They don't have sentience to be able to figure out. They just instinctively know to stay away from certain smells and certain sounds. But these appear to be beings that make decisions, that think, that plan.
Yes, I do believe that. And, you know, they're stealthy enough that, you know, my favorite analogy is, if you have a special forces soldier and he's in full camo and he's in the woods and you don't know he's there, you probably could walk within a foot of him and never know he's there. Well, that's their home, so they can do the same thing with us. They actually, you know, can hide so very well, and they're very quick and they're very silent.
When you say quick, are they, you know, as fast as they hear?
Fast.
Wow. So more than one have been observed doing what? Sleeping, running, climbing? What were they doing?
Well, there's several good videos out there that I feel are real, that that shown them running and sleeping. Obviously, the one I have with the paper, she's sleeping. They're like any other individual. They run, they sleep, they watch us, they do different things that are, you know, would be normal considering.
Have you ever heard them make a sound, or is any of the observer?
Oh, yeah, they definitely make sound. And sometimes they'll even answer you back if you, you know, try to interact with them.
By answering, is it just grunts and snorts, or do they appear to have some kind of language?
They have a type of language. It's a very quickly spoken language. Plus, they can imitate just about any sound that they want to imitate. You can tell it's not quite there, but it certainly sounds like it to somebody who's not looking for it.
Wow. What are their eating habits? Are they omnivores or just strictly
vegetarian?
They're
omnivores like we are.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, I'm fascinated by the subject, as are a lot of, you know, explorers, but there has not been much real evidence. As you say, there's been a lot of rumor and conjecture and theory, crazy movies and things like that. I always enjoyed Harry and the Hendersons, but
oh, that's cute. Yeah, me too.
where do you go from here with DNA diagnostics? How do you hope to really establish that there's another species of human or humanid or hominin out there that
it's already been established. The three genomes, I mean, absolutely do that. It's just the skeptics out there that don't want to accept sound science. I mean, we sent these out as blind studies. You know, it was unbiased in the reporting back to us. We made sure there was no contamination working out of a forensic science basis. Where people that do forensics are experts with mixtures and contamination. So we certainly know how to prevent it and how to know if we have it. And these samples were clean and pristine, and we took the same extractions that we did, and we separated them into aliquots to send to the different labs. So it's like everybody was working with the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we took every precaution there. So, I mean, it's proven. It's just getting mainstream science to go along. But I think that will happen, you know, for too many weeks. Because we, like I say, we've had people that are far more famous than anything I could hope to achieve that have come forward and are actually independently, you know, taking our data and recreating it to confirm what's been done.
Well, that's great. So the aliquots are going around as blind and even double blind samples, and they're confirming your sequencing, and that's excellent science. That's the way.
Yes, that's what we did in the paper. And like I say, then we had people come forward and want to basically, you know, show that what we had was valid. And we've allowed a couple of them, you know, to do this because we, you know, want obviously the scientific community to be more comfortable with it. You know, it is. I have a saying. It is what it is. I mean, the data's good. It's just we can't make it be an ape. We can't make it be something that it's not. That would be wrong to report, you know, data that isn't what, you know, we were given back from the labs. And you know, we took exactly, you know, what was done, like on the genomes at the University of Texas Southwestern. They, you know, they did the sequencing, didn't know what it was, couldn't believe that it didn't align perfect with humans. And then, you know, one of their bioinformaticists, you know, worked the data up. And, you know, we had another laboratory, the University Laboratory, North Texas Health Science Center, confirm the alignments and all. So, I mean, we've done everything we can possibly do at this point as far as with me at the helm to get a valid paper with good, pristine data. And, you know, but I think that it's going to take, you know, I kind of in quotes put say it's going to take a famous scientist to come in and say, yeah, this is good data. And, you know, I believe that will happen. Our quality scores were very high, and we can't help the data is interesting. But, like I say, the Genome Center, I have no reason to believe that they're that the methodology is flawed in any way, especially when the quality scores are out of their hands. It's done by the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and plus they have quality check in place.
All statistics aside, it sounds like you've developed a passion for the subject. And one of my listeners from Slovenia asks, how did the hybrids come to exist? Now, we kind of already answered that in the way we said, well, we had an extreme environmental condition 15,000 years ago that may have exacerbated a mutation that had a survivability. But what if it really was two different species that came together to mate and provide this offspring? Do you have any ideas what the two origin species were?
Well, obviously, you know, modern human females were the female fraction of this hybrid. We do not know what the male was. We have no idea. It was just, it obviously was some type of primate, but it doesn't have any of the modern apes, as far as we're not finding little shared sequence with them, and the same with, you know, there's things outside of human there too. So, I mean, we don't know what the male is, and that's still yet to be explored. And, you know, there's all types of fossils in this world, and, you know, we're discovering new species from fossil record, you know, all the time. I mean, look at the Denisovan individual. I mean, that's a relatively recent discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it will probably, the male fraction will probably come from some type of individual like that. However, the Sasquatch as a species, we believe, like I say, are hybrids, and that they will be, you know, that they are not, we don't think that there, or we don't know that there's any of the progenitor males still around. We have no idea, but we don't think they are. We think that that probably is a species that did go extinct at some point, leaving the hybrid. And, you know, when you study genetics and even medicine, there's something called hybrid vigor, where sometimes when you have something that crosses, like the resulting offspring is actually more viable and more robust than the two individuals that created this hybrid. And I mean, you know, you see it commonly in like cattle breeding, where you know take two breeds of cattle and you cross them. A lot of times the resulting offspring, although admittedly those are both, you know, cattle, but still the resulting offspring is more robust than the purebred animals they came from.
Sure, that makes total sense. So, but when did this progeny occur? You say 15,000 years ago?
Well, actually, one of our we have a couple that are actually 13,000 years ago. So it's, you know, the hybridization event could not have occurred prior to that, because those mitochondrial haplotypes didn't exist at that time. So, you know, we don't have an exact date as to when it happened, but we know it couldn't have been any older than that. It couldn't have happened before that time, because those, you know, to our knowledge, because those haplotypes were not in existence before that date.
Well, when you say modern humans, are you talking about Cro-Magnon, or are you talking about Neanderthal descendants, or modern humans like we see on the streets of, you know, modern cities today?
The haplotypes we got are, could be, you could go to any city and pick out some random individuals, and they'll probably share, you know, a haplotype with some of these individuals. And so, I mean, it is, you know, human beings like we are that, you know, they originated with. And, of course, that goes back thousands of years, just, you know, to that. But nevertheless, it's modern human females is what we're getting. And now, that's not to say that somewhere out there the cross didn't go the other direction. And we have some mitochondrial DNA that's going to be very different from what we're getting. But let's just say, from what we're seeing out of, you know, 100-plus samples, we did not see any mitochondrial DNA that would allude to it being an actual, you know, an unknown type of species as far as the mitochondrial DNA. With that said, we tested some different parts of the Y chromosome, and we got some very unusual results there. When you do ancestry on your paternal origins, you get what's called YSTRs, which is the test they use. It's a length of DNA they test that is inherited from father to son and so on. And it's kind of the reverse of mitochondrial DNA, where it comes from the mother. Well, this comes from the father. And we ran YSTRs on our male samples, and they would not run. We only had one that got any results at all on the. And we think that probably was a back cross where the individual, at some point, they crossed back, a male somehow crossed with a female Sasquatch, which, you know, there is historical record for that with the story of Zaina and Quit out of Russia, where they had eyewitnesses that a young female Sasquatch, or wild man as they call them, had been captured. And basically, as she grew older, the men of the town used her for sport, and she ended up having six children with human fathers, and you know, four of which survived. One of them up in, you know, fairly well into this century. So, you know, it can work the other way, but it's, you know, like I say, out of all those samples, we only had one that actually showed any human YSTRs. So it's not like we can, you know, trace the origin very easily on the male side at this point. It's going to have to come from the whole
genome. And that's another question that's come up, is the origin. Because it appears the population is sparse but widespread, that is to say, it exists in the Northwest, in Russia, or in the Siberian regions, and maybe in the Himalayas, who knows where else. How did such a sparse population that's been around for a long, long time, maybe longer than modern humans have been since recorded history anyway, why is the population so sparse, and why is it yet so widespread with similar genetic features?
They're widespread, but there's a lot more of them than people think. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of these individuals. I know I was invited. There's people called, they call themselves habituators. Some of them call them witnesses, but they usually live in forested rural areas, and they actually, the Sasquatch get used to them, and they have a certain amount of interaction with them. And they actually were kind enough a couple of years ago. I mean, I did not believe they existed when I started 5 years ago. The DNA convinced me pretty early on when we started getting some really interesting results that, you know, we had what we had, but it was trying to amass enough proof to please the scientific community. But anyway, 2 years ago, they issued an invitation for me to come actually out to a site where the Sasquatch, you know, live. And, I mean, there were five of them at this particular location. So, I mean, I've been elsewhere where there's been, you know, anywhere from 5 to 12 at one time. And, I mean, they look, you know, they appear to be family units. And the people that do, that have the habituators are very, very careful about letting anybody know who they are, where they are, for two or three major reasons. You know, one is that, you know, people would generally, at least up until now, say that they're crazy because, you know, oh, they're you know, dealing with Bigfoot. Oh, that's, you know, that's crazy. And so they don't want that stigma. Second, they don't want curiosity seekers and or hunters coming around their property wanting to try to see one or hunt one, as the case may be. So they don't want people to know who they are and where they live. But I was able to gain their trust by, you know, doing what I'm doing. And they knew I had taken a stand that, you know, the species needs to be protected. And they came out and actually invited me. So, I've been able to have some sightings and interaction to an extent. And with that said, you know, they're far, far, far more numerous than we think. They just are so good at staying concealed that, you know, they live under our noses all the time, and you know, at least in forested areas. And people, they're so careful that they just don't really realize all of the signs that they're there unless they just kind of come out to them.
Well, that is a good point. You say that they live in family units. Are these family units like dolphin pods where they normally live like 20 to 40 to a pod and they rarely form, you know, large societies? And do they understand family units? In other words, is there a father, a mother, and children that stay together as a family unit? Or
yes,
are,
they do.
Okay. All right.
They're very loyal to their families. Most people that have had a, quote, scary encounter, they've probably gotten too close to their young because they're very protective of their young. And, depending on how much they trust the people around, if a stranger comes into their area, though, they're probably going to escort them out. And with that said, the ones I've come in contact with, have not been aggressive at all. They've been, very, very subtle and what have you. But, there are the occasional, they're a type of people, so there's bad ones also out there. One should not go out in the woods looking for them, per se. I don't believe that at all, especially not alone. And, if they encounter one, and it's not one that lives around their house and they're used to it, they need to just ease away and, be very, cautious, because, like I say, it's kind of like hitchhiking. You don't know who's going to pick you up. There's no reason to fear them, because, you've lived your life this far without them. I really wish that people would just, the only thing they need protecting from is us. I wish that people would just live their lives and forget they exist and leave them in their habitat to, to themselves. And they don't need, protection of habitat either, because they're able to live just very close in under our noses and have survived, all these hundreds and hundreds of years and thousands of years right under our noses. They don't need our help for that. They just need to keep the hunters out of the woods to keep from being hunted. And the other problem is that, with hunters trying to bag a Bigfoot to, quote, prove it, they are liable to shoot a human being, because there's people out in the woods, they're hiking or other ones hunting or what have you, and they're looking for something that walks up right now. And if they don't get a good view of that whatever's walking upright, they're liable to shoot another human being. So there needs to be some very careful controls put on, any of this, and they should not be allowed to be hunted or harassed. There's ways to study them without, more, I guess you could say, sort of like the Jane Goodall approach versus, trying to just, run them out of their habitat so they can be seen or whatever. That's just wrong.
How tall are the adults?
I'm sorry?
How tall are the adults?
From personal experience, the tallest one I've seen is 10 feet. Generally, probably the average is 8 to 9 feet in a male and 7 to 8 feet in a female.
So that's as tall as an elk, except they walk upright. What do you think they weigh, 400, 500 pounds?
It depends on their body build. There is individual, they have as many differences as you and I do. There's tall, slender ones, but more commonly, they're very thick built. I know that I had an extended viewing of a male that was about 8 foot tall, and his shoulders were probably 4 foot wide. He was very blocky and very, very muscular. He had to have weighed somewhere between 500 and 700 pounds on a guess. He was, obviously as large as any cow or horse.
That's something that would leave a heck of a footprint.
Then they do. That's something that's been pretty well established all over, is the footprints. They just look like, basically bare human footprints.
Are they tool users, or did they just, forage?
Now, I believe they have some tool use. They live a simple life. I don't think it's because they're mentally simple at all. I think it's more of a choice. I think they have actually learned to live like they do, because if you go back in historical record, you can, and especially in Europe in the Middle Ages, Dark Ages, and even up until the time before Christ, in the manuscript we even have pulled some four photos of artwork that's been through all these centuries. It showed that man was, for the most part, trying to attack them, we have one where they're burning one at the stake, and these are hundreds and you know, thousands of years old. So, you know, they've got reason to stay away from us.
One of my listeners, again in Slovenia, wants to know, have you communicated with them?
There are certain ways that you know, communication can occur. You know, sometimes they will leave little gifts for the people that the habituators, you know, stones, bones, or, you know, some kind of something that shouldn't be where it is. And, you know, conversely, they accept gifts oftentimes, too. You know, and we're talking about habituation. We're not talking about one running across the road and accidentally getting seen, or somebody accidentally getting a glimpse of one as they're hiking through the woods. We're talking about the ones that live around people and are used to them. There can be certain interchanges that occur.
This appears to be, you know, at least an intelligent, sentient being with complex family arrangements. You know, even bears and bear cubs will stay loyal to one another until the bears are, you know, of adult age. Then the sow kind of runs the two cubs off, and they have to fend for themselves, and all that motherly instinct goes away. But these family units appear to stay together throughout the generation, and semi-tool users. So obviously, you know, they're intelligent, they're organizers, they're able to stay out of the view of ordinary people. Has anyone ever, you know, found a dead one, a skeleton, a skull, or a bone of one?
Well, now, this is according to the habituators that I've been fortunate enough to meet. And there are literally hundreds of them here in the United States. They all say unanimously, whether they know each other or not, that they bury their dead. And I believe that, because I think that's a lot of reason that there haven't been, you know, to this point, any bodies that have been, you know, available.
You know, I've seen, I haven't seen myself, but I have spoken to people who know dolphins really well. And they say that when a dolphin, you know, dies of old age, or is ill and dies, or a baby dies, that the pod of dolphins will show reverence, that they will, you know, escort the dolphin to the bottom and, you know, let things be as they may. Obviously, a dolphin can't bury their dead, but there is an intelligence, a communion with the individual of the pod. If there's a reverence enough for the individual that makes up, you know, a component of this society, so much so that they don't want the body to be, you know, ravaged by wild animals, that they will bury their dead, that shows a very high level of development.
Yes, and I'm quite sure they are developed way past what most people think. They see a large being that is covered in hair, that has a skull that's a little more Neanderthal type, like, and have the prominent brow ridge and all, but yet are very human in the face. But they see these, they think just the hair and the brow ridge makes them think, oh, it's an ape. But that's the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, you just have to, I mean, for the most part, they're very similar to us morphologically. They have, you know, more human-like hands and feet. And like I said, when I started this and I started getting the unusual results, I really thought we were going to end up potentially with some type of Neanderthal-type being, just because if you look at the skeletal remains of the Neanderthal, you know, they have the more barrel chest, they have the longer arms, they have a lot of the similar, you know, morphologic appearance that you know, the Sasquatch do. But once again, as we got further into study, we realized that isn't really quite the case, that, you know, they may be more similar in structure, perhaps, but, you know, these are a different type of person. They're unique. They're not, you know, the mitochondrial DNA did not show the differences you would see with Neanderthal or the Denisovan individual. So, you know, once again, it's a type of people. And, you know, most people that have had a real close-up encounter, I'm talking a face-to-face type of encounter, they'll tell you that, you know, how human they actually do look in their face and, you know, in their shape to a large extent.
Very interesting.
And I mean, the ones I've seen have been, you know, human looking.
So we have DNA samples, the irrefutable proof, well, that is to say within statistical bounds of error, that's been peer-reviewed. We have a paper out, legitimate science. We have photographs, movies, personal testimony from hundreds of different habituators. Where do we go from here with this? What is the goal of your project?
Well, we'll be working on different genes and what have you. I mean, obviously, there's years of work to be done on the genome. A genome is, we have like 3 terabytes of data to go through. So this, we wanted to get it proven that they really do exist. First of all, the next step will be, starting into actually, more decoding the genome and actually comparing different genes to human and what have you. The other thing we're working on is we're pulling habituators together, and we're writing up a lot of they're sending things to us blindly where we know, the types of interactions they've had, and those that independently are confirmed by another habituator that, say from across the country that they don't know, we're putting together data to try to get a better picture of them socially and, in more of a way that they can be understood by the general public.
One of our listeners writes the question, how human-looking are they? What about their teeth? Do they have, like, dog-like teeth or human-like teeth? We're omnivores, and, we have teeth for biting off and for, chewing vegetables as well. And have you ever recovered a tooth or a bite pattern?
We have, and we actually are working on some teeth now that we believe did come from Sasquatch, but we worked with fresh tissues or fresh dried tissues first because they are quicker and easier to deal with. But we're now working on the bones that we have. We have some teeth and bones, and we're working to confirm that those are the same species as the tissue and hair samples that we worked with in the study.
Do you think these are related to, or at least maybe some of the skeletons related to the giants of old? We've found skeletons around the United States, especially the southeastern United States, of 9 and 10 foot hominins. They appear to be more human, except for the skull shapes a little more elongated in the back, and sometimes multiple rows of teeth or 6 fingers and toes. But you think they could be related?
I'm not really thinking that they are. The reason being that we did have one of those types of samples at one point submitted to the study, and it has had some previous work attached to it as well as we did some work, and it does not appear to they're more ancient, and it appears to be it doesn't have the same, I guess, genetic fingerprint as does the Sasquatch samples. So we feel that, not to say that quote, all of the giants out there are, not Sasquatch, but we know some of them are not.
Excellent. Excellent. Outstanding work. We're just fascinated by good science, and I'm also embarrassed by the pride of science, that how blind they can be. I know they want you to bring your proof forward, but to be just flat-out prejudiced or be so willing to throw out legitimate data is just not scientific. It's more religious. I hate to even use that word.
Well, the religion is Darwinism, because this isn't exactly, the model being for evolution here, and that doesn't make people very happy that have lived their entire lives basing their scientific knowledge on, that theory. And, does evolution exist? Yes, in theory and in some forms, it definitely does. But just because things are not exactly how you would expect them to be, that you shouldn't discount good data, and that's what they've done. We've even been, one of the peer reviews even mocked us. It was, terrible, made fun of our paper. And the thing is, all they can do is that and say that, oh, it's got to be contaminated, it can't be real, it can't be this or that, even though we have all the proofs in there. It's not so much the critique of the paper as it is the critique that they just don't believe the data. And I don't know how to deal with that. If they don't believe, they don't believe. What, take them out in the woods and let them see one? I guess that's, you know, going to be, you know, the next step.
Well, I've never found belief to be a legitimate part of science. It's more the infection.
I agree. I mean, it's like, you know, we tried to, everything from the very beginning, we tried to take it to the very top journals. And, you know, there were a myriad of unbelievable responses.
I can only imagine.
You know, but, I mean, we're confident in our data. I mean, you know, what we did, we're confident in. What we've sent out and gotten back, we're confident in. I mean, we don't think that, you know, large universities and well-known accredited laboratories are going to all of them botch up testing. It just isn't going to happen.
Totally fascinating. You know, DNA is such a complex molecule anyway. It's the idea that the first protein, you know, made by genes, built by DNA, it has to be an engineered molecule. I'm not a molecular biologist by any means, but I've read a lot of books on it, and it just seems to be that DNA was an engineered molecule. It just wasn't put together by random amino acids forming DNA and then life from there. Maybe life was seeded here from somewhere else, which kind of, you know, brings a third school of thought to, you have creationism, you have evolution, and then you got some cross in between that where it's just natural selection inside each species. But the third school of thought is intervention of some kind, that someone outside the set of intelligence that's already here on this planet got involved. Whether you want to call them gods or visitors or other leftover civilizations from civilizations past on Earth, it's hard to say. You know, you've already mentioned that humans involved themselves with Sasquatch descendants on purpose. They captured one and bred with it, and it had six children. That's intervention. That's direct intervention from a more highly intelligent species to one that is captured and being manipulated. Who's to say that didn't happen 15,000 years ago?
That's just it. We don't know. And, you know, I don't think that anything we've done could possibly, you know, support any one theory. And I know there's going to be, you know, I pretty well know there's going to be several theories out there, like you just, you know, discussed, as to how they actually came into being. But, you know, we're just going to stick with our science and let everybody else have their opinion.
Well, that's good. And some of the science is genetics and samples and collecting data and then data treatment to come up with high levels of confidence that your results are right. And the other is the social observation, the sociology of the community, how the fathers react to their children as they grow up. Do they compete with them or do they push them out like a wolf pack would do? How is that interaction in the family unit itself over time?
Well, back to the, you know, the habituators, you know, we believe that they, you know, they stay fairly close, although I think they're really a lot more like, I think a lot of their way of living is somewhat similar to the American Indians, the Native Americans that live here. They interacted with them for, you know, centuries before, you know, we came from Europe to come over here and you know, basically take this country from them. And I think that a lot of the way, I mean, they live in, you know, groups which, you know, appear more like a tribe from, you know, like I say, and this is talking to a lot of independent habituators, and they have their families that, you know, they live, and then they live in within a group that's larger, a type of tribe, and, you know, they do have social structure from everything we've seen, and they have the intelligence to do that, of course, and so, you know, and once again, that plays into why nobody sees you know, or has interaction that much is because they're very careful who they have interaction with. They can read a person. They have the skill of an animal at reading a person, as well as they have, you know, a human-like intelligence on top of it that allows them to, you know, they really, it's going to be under their circumstances. They're only going to approach certain people. And I'm quite sure of that, having, you know, dealt with as many people as I have, because, you know, as of a couple of years ago, whenever, you know, the word of the study had been leaked out, you know, there were people coming forward by droves, and still do, that, you know, have amazing experiences with them. And that's back to us gathering the data to try to give, you know, us a better understanding of them as a, you know, a society with a type of culture.
Do you think the American Indians, obviously being in this land, living within the bounds of nature and in harmony with it for centuries and centuries before, you know, Europeans ever got here, do you think they ever interacted with them and gave them their space or traded with them?
Oh, I'm positive of it. I mean, I've actually, you know, had contact with some, you know, of the various American Indians, and they have had a lot more interaction than, you know, people outside of their culture. Once again, they have a history with them, and they respect them as a type of people, and you know, they have, almost all the tribes have names for them, and I would say, you know, at least 95% of them have a positive view of them, a live and let live attitude. They coexist. You know, you're going to have a couple, you know, there's an occasional tribe that thinks they're bad, but then again, it could be the geography, because once again, there's most of them are peace-loving, and they avoid people, and but there's the occasional group that's, you know, not so nice. You know, but it once again, it's no reason for anybody to really fear them. To, you know, just if you're going deep into woods where you're not familiar with, take someone with you. I mean, that's just good sense anyway. And you know, stay to where the Park Service has it marked and around, and you know, there shouldn't be any reason for people to avoid national parks or to change their lifestyles in any way, because, you know, face it. There would be, you know, if they were bad in any number, there would be a lot more dead people out there or missing people than there are. So, you know, we just encourage people to use common sense and live their lives normally, and chances are they'll never even see one.
I spent a little bit of time in the backcountry in Yosemite. There are areas that you can only canoe up into, and they're 2 or 3 miles away from, you know, where the normal traffic is. There's no foot trails up there. You have to canoe up through, you know, pretty rough territory to get up to these upper lakes. And I've seen moose up there, and I've never seen any bears, thank goodness. But yeah. Moose could be pretty aggressive too.
That's any wild animal that feels that they're threatened by a human. You know, I mean, like I say, you probably are safer with the Sasquatch in most cases than you would be, you know, like you say, a bear or, you know, another type of large mammal. Because generally they'll just avoid you.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about maybe their level of compassion. Because, you know, every once in a while these backpackers, they'll go up there in pairs sometimes. Or sometimes, like you say, crazy enough, they'll go by themselves. And they'll get themselves in trouble. They'll get snowed in, or they break an ankle or something like that, and can't, you know, miles back up in the backcountry. Have you ever heard of a Sasquatch coming out and, you know, rendering any kind of aid or exposing
themselves?
Yeah,
there are stories out there where that has happened. One in particular, a man did break his leg and was not near the trail, and allegedly the Sasquatch picked him up and took him over to the side of a road and set him down and left him there so he would be found. You know, there's a good handful of those kind of stories out there. So, you know, they occasionally do have compassion on us and do help out from, you know, all the stories can't be wrong. So I think at least some of them probably have some degree of truth to them in that way. I think they can be helpful and sometimes are.
Do they have an ability to keep wild animals from preying on them, like a wolf pack will try to, you know, carve off a young and, you know, attack it? Or do they just their size or something about their smell or presence keep the predators away. I assume they have no natural enemies other than man.
That I believe that's correct. You know, they're large enough they can defend themselves, very strong, and, you know, therefore can defend themselves against most creatures. And once again, most creatures are not going to argue with something that's larger than they are. And, you know, they can be very loud. They can make, you know, very loud vocalizations, which once again will tend to scare away any predators.
I think I could be very loud too if a wolf was harassing me. I'm not sure it would help much, but you know, an animal that is that big and that strong and can use a tool, pick up a stick or something like that, I imagine could defend themselves against any kind of animal. How do they sleep? Do they make shelters for themselves? Do they live in caves or out in the open?
I think it's probably all of the above. The short video clip that the Erickson Project donated to the to be supplemental to the manuscript, that she's actually sleeping in the woods. But I think, you know, I know that there's a lot of, you know, once again, I go back to all the eyewitness reports that have come to me and what have you, that, you know, they do, you know, stay in caves. There's stick structures you can find sometimes where you can see where either saplings have been bent over or they're even kind of teepee looking and leaves and what have you been piled on, so that there's, you know, they do make a type of shelter some places. Other places they go in caves, other places they just sleep in the open. I think there's a variety of ways that they are, depending on how comfortable they are in their habitat and how much they think that, you know, somebody might come along and bother them.
Well, hopefully in the coming months, as your research goes on, and by the way, Sonia asks from Slovenia if you have enough financing for your research. Where is it coming from? How are you funded, and do you need more?
We could always use more, because the primary funding came from two sources. That's like, you know, 99% of it came from two sources. The first one being a gentleman named Wally Hersom, who I'm extremely indebted to, who funded all of this, the outsourced testing we did, to, you know, a huge amount of money that he donated to get this done. A very good guy, you know, and then the other one was Adrian Erickson with the Erickson Project. He also put in a relatively large sum of money to kickstart the thing off in the beginning. So, you know, I'm indebted to them for this study, and, you know, they're both excited about the study that, you know, we've achieved as much as we have. In the future, yeah, we could use more money, because it's going to take a lot of money to mine through the genome to the extent that needs to be done. So we need to hire more people to do that. You know, we're able to do, you know, some at this point. It's just we're not able to do it as fast as if we had, a, you know, two or three people actually working on it at the same time.
Well, hopefully you'll find a cooperative way to get a full, you know, bite pattern, maybe blood samples, you know, stuff like that. I don't know if they'll sit there and have their blood taken, but
we
never
did have a blood sample in the study. One of the genomes came from a blood sample.
Wow.
So, I mean, we've got a number of different types of samples. You know, the samples are the least of the worries. We come up with the samples. You know, and now it's just going through the massive amount of data that we have. You know, which once again, when we aligned these genomes, they came up as being unknown primate. You know, with the interspersed human sequence, of course. But what's interesting is that they all basically came off of the phylogenetic tree at the same spot, meaning that the three genomes are from three different individuals from three different parts of this country, and they all came up as the same species. So, you know, we know what we got. We're happy with our results. Now it's just a matter of going through and pulling different genes and starting to study the genes individually in the genomes.
Great. Great. And maybe we can look at the population globally and see if there's some stratification to see if they've been separated that long and actually developed.
Preliminarily, no. We do have some Russian samples, and we have some preliminary results on one of those samples, and it looks very similar to what we've already got, at least as far as the mitochondrial DNA.
Wow, that's amazing. So we have common origin and then a spread of the population.
Yes, and they are worldwide. I mean, you know, they're even in Australia. They call them Yowies in Australia. And, of course, there's, you know, Yetis in Asia and wild men in Russia and, you know, various names for them worldwide.
One of my listeners asked the question, do you think they're spiritual? Do they have a communion with nature, or do they I don't know how you would even answer that question.
Well, I think they probably are, from the habituator report, that they definitely appear to be. You know, I just, once again, and I when I speak on something like this, it's confirmed by more than one habituator that don't necessarily know each other. So, you know, this is how I validate what I, or I feel that, you know, we get a certain amount of validation of what we're told, is that, you know, if John Doe gives me a report from the East Coast and he doesn't know this guy in Arizona that's giving me a report and they're saying the same thing, you have to give it a little credibility here.
Now, what is the report? Do they dance like Indians do? Do they have a ritual or a pattern? Do they make altars? Well, not like altars, like to sacrifice something on, but to like pray to. Is there some behavior that they do?
They seem to have reverence for the earth. I mean, you know, similar to your American Indian cultures. I think they might have picked up a fair amount of their culture from the native populations here. I can't speak for the rest of the world, just, you know, but for here, it seems that a lot of their, you know, beliefs are you know, very much seem to be tied in with, you know, similar, and I'm saying similar with respect to the earth and what have you. You know, some of the habituators go further than that, but I'm, at this point, until we get more habituators on board telling us, you know, their experiences, you know, we're not going to go a lot further than I do believe they are, you know, have their own spirituality within their species.
Sounds completely fascinating. I'm overjoyed you came on the program. Sorry about the communication problem between us. I had an email.
No, it's no problem. It's, you know, like I say, there was only one concern there, and you addressed that.
Yeah, no, it's not a problem. Well, that's excellent. So where is your study going to go from here? I know I asked the question, but didn't get a full answer. We're going to more fully develop this, and we're going to make a presentation. Are you going to do a book with pictures?
Well, there'll be more papers, and there'll be, you know, I'm sure at some point there'll be a book. But, you know, I'm more worried about working on data right this minute, and also to gathering the habituator reports. And, you know, I actually have now acquired a habituator site myself, where, you know, I can go and make observations also myself. So there's a lot of you know, work being done in the background that we'll be releasing as we, you know, get it compiled and you know, ready for consumption.
Excellent, excellent. One of my listeners asked, do they make music and do they draw?
I have a picture that's going to be on one of the websites. We've had some technical difficulties with our websites, which I want to apologize for, but there is a habituator that had some drawings put on a tree in her property, not where anybody would go that was, you know, one of you or I, and very strange drawings. So, you know, they've been known to make, you know, drawings and carvings to an extent. You know, they also, like I say, will leave stick structures that have meanings out in the woods, where they'll bend trees around and what have you, that it's very obviously not a naturally occurring type of situation. Most people walking through deep forests don't walk right past those structures and not realize they're there until they've seen one, and then they see them, you know, quite commonly after that. So, I mean, you know, they have different ways. You know, sometimes they'll, one I personally had at my site is an X made of bone was placed where it was a very obvious spot for me to see.
Interesting.
So, I mean, they have their ways, and, you know, we're just scratching the very, very, very surface of it. It's we still have volumes and volumes to learn. my main goal at this point is to get them protected from us, first of all. To me, that's very important.
How are you going about
this? People, and they don't deserve to be hunted. Or harassed, for that matter.
How are you going about this? Are we going to the Department of Interior, or are we trying to get a law passed to protect them? How are we going about
that's
that?
That's what we want to do is, you know, we want them to be protected. You know, and we're not asking for habitat to be assigned, you know, or cause any kind of government problem like that. You know, what we want in protection is a live and let live type of thing. Just, you know, we don't want them hunted or harassed. I mean, you know, obviously, if you are able to corner one, which is difficult to do, but if you are, I mean, they're like you or me or any animal, they'll fight back. And so we don't want people forcing their way into basically their living rooms trying to study them in a way that is invasive. The best way to study is to let them come to us, which they do. And, you know, we just want them, you know, to be left alone and protected in that way from us. I mean, right now, there's just everybody wants to just, quote, prove Bigfoot. We've already done that. We just haven't done it in the way that people think it should be done, like by killing one. And,
right.
You know, that is wrong. That's murder because they're a type of human.
Or
and
capturing one for a zoo, for crying out loud.
But, I mean, you know, one of the TV shows actually has put a bounty on their head, which is even worse. So you have all these groups out there trying to kill one. It's just horrible.
Wow. That's, well, hopefully listeners who hear this program tonight will find out what actions are being taken in their area and support them.
Well, we're in the process. We're going to have a website up shortly. We already have the Sasquatch Genome Project website. For whatever reason, we have a glitch with the security certificate, so we're having to work that around. But we're going to have a link to where we have a foundation for them for protection. Anybody that's interested in helping protect them or supporting us in that, they can email us, at media@SasquatchGenomeProject.org, and we can hook them up with other people in their area. You know, the other thing we're doing is we're trying to hook people up that have seen them and need to talk about it or have, have a habituation and don't quite know what to do about it. We're trying to hook them up with people that can help counsel them on that, that have had these experiences so they can at least talk to somebody about it. Because it can be very, very hard on people to, and you know, I have a personal experience with this. And it's really embarrassing to me. Back in 95, I had a friend that had a sighting, and, of course, I didn't believe they existed. And, you know, I was as bad as anybody. I teased her mercilessly and said she was seeing things and hallucinating everything else. And now I'm so ashamed of my behavior because I just really – I didn't believe that she saw what she saw. And you know, it frightened her really badly. She needed to talk to somebody who had had a sighting before to, you know, not be so afraid. And, I mean, I was no help. I teased her. So I understand why habituators keep in the background. They don't want this, you know, the craziness spun them. But we are trying to set up networks where we can help people, and you know, they can at least talk about it.
And your website is SasquatchGenomeProject.org, correct?
Yes, and the one that will be up in the next, hopefully within less than a week, is MelbaKetchum.org, which is the foundation. It'll be the Melba Ketchum Sasquatch, Global Sasquatch Foundation. And just go to MelbaKetchum.org. But it's not up yet. We're doing, you know, some finishing touches on it. But it will be within the next week or so.
All right. Where do you think the largest population is? Is it in the Northwest or Russia or Australia?
I would say that... Probably two places stick out in mind, the wilds of Siberia and along the chain of the Rockies and Sierras up into Canada. Anywhere where there's less people, there's going to be more Sasquatch. Although there's, you know, anywhere it's forested, they're going to be there. It's just that I think they probably live in larger numbers away from us. And
mm-hmm.
And if you'll notice, I mean, you know, you can go online and see different reports from different places that there's been sightings in every state of the Union and in all of Canada with the exception of Hawaii. So they are basically widespread.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Hey, I really appreciate you coming on the program, Dr. Melba Ketchum. We'll have her websites posted at xsquaredradio.com.
Well, I appreciate you having me very much.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I appreciate it very much. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Just please support their protection because, you know, they're one of our greatest treasures because they're the closest thing that's alive today to us. And, you know, they're extant. They live amongst us. And, you know, we should have that respect.
Perfect. Again, thank you very much, Dr. Ketchum, for coming on X Squared Radio. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We'll say goodnight then. Have a wonderful week.
Good
and
night.
If anything
thank
comes
you,
up, be sure to email me. You always have a home here. If you have a breakthrough or something you want to get out really quick, an alert of some kind, let me know. I'll make a space for you, and you can come right on, and we'll talk about it.
That sounds wonderful. I really appreciate that. You take care.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Good night.
Good night.
All right, Earth Explorers, let's go ahead and take a quick break. We ran about a half hour long on that segment, but that's okay. It's my program. I can do what I want to do. Let's listen to a little Alice Band, and we'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio, second hour, February 24th. Really enjoyed Dr. Melba Ketchum coming on in the last hour. If you missed it, it'll be posted in the archives tonight. Lots of interesting stuff going on out there. You know, I'm so amazed at discoveries one after the other being made and good science being brought forward. And if we can find it, we'll bring it to you here on X Squared Radio. That's what we do. Also, want to let you know there's another bright comet coming. Comet Pan-STARRS, discovered by the Pan-STARRS telescope in Hawaii in 2011, is coming next month, March of this year. It could maybe, possibly be the blue Kachina predicted by the Hopi, or perhaps it could be Comet Ison coming in November. Both of these comets will be visible with the naked eye and very well with an ordinary pair of binoculars. Of course, you'll be able to see Comet Ison in the daylight. Now, that's amazing. It will be the brightest comet, certainly in recent history and maybe even in recorded history. I would suggest you have some time. It's not expensive to make. I would suggest making a binocular holder. It's very simple. It bolts onto the arms of an ordinary office chair. You just need some PVC piping and some cheap clamps or even Velcro. If you would like plans for a simple binocular holder for a swivel office chair with armrests, let me know. I'll send you the plans. Contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll send you the drawings. And all you need is a little PVC pipe glue and a hacksaw. And, you know, some ordinary clamps that you can buy at the hardware store. And let me tell you, the reason you need this is because you can't hold the binoculars as long as you want to look at this comet. Your arms are going to get tired. But if you bolt this to an office chair, it will hold the binoculars for you. And then you can just lay back in the chair and look through the binoculars and just swivel the chair around. It's amazing. You can see the moon very clearly. You can see other planets, and you certainly will be able to see these comets. So just give me a call. I got a little bit of an audio maybe you can listen to and hear a little bit about this new comet that's coming out, Comet Pan-STARRS. Tell me what you think.
Earth, sky. There's a lot of excitement about Comet ISON, which might become a very bright comet visible across the globe by the end of 2013.
But before ISON, or Comet Ison, comes around, a second comet, Comet Pan-STARRS, might become visible to the eye alone in March of 2013. In October 2012, this comet's surrounding coma, an envelope of ice and dust around its central nucleus, was seen to be large and fine. That's an indication the comet might be becoming active as it nears the sun. In March 2013, by some estimates, Comet Pan-STARRS should get as bright as Venus.
However, comets are notoriously difficult to predict. As comet hunter David Levy once said, comets are like cats. They have tails, and they do precisely what they want. This comet will be closest to Earth on March 5th, but not very close. It'll be no closer than Earth is to the sun. But then, on March 10th, the comet will be closest to the sun, about as close as the innermost planet Mercury. Comets are typically brightest and most active around the time they are closest to the sun. The comet should brighten around then and also develop the long, classic comet dust tail.
That's Comet Pan-STARRS, one of two bright comets expected this year. For more about them, come to earthsky.org and search for Comets in 2013. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Well, there you go. We always like to help out the organizations that teach you about astronomy. I am a amateur astronomer in the sense that I love to look at the stars, probably do it every night that I possibly can. And here in North Carolina, we have the best dark skies for stargazing of anywhere on the eastern seaboard. It just happens to be the way the weather patterns work out here. You've heard about Carolina blue sky. Well, we certainly get the Carolina clear skies at night, so we get a lot of great stargazing here. In recent science, scientists have created a sixth sense brain implant to detect infrared light. I know, it sounds pretty spooky, but a brain implant which could allow humans to detect invisible infrared light has been developed by scientists in America. Scientists have created this by putting an implant into lab rats, and they were able to detect light that's not normally visible via electrodes in the part of the brain responsible for their sense of touch. Similar devices have previously been used to make up for lost capabilities, for example, giving paralyzed patients the ability to move a cursor around the screen with their thoughts. But the new study by researchers from Duke University, right here in North Carolina, is the first case in which such devices have been used to give an animal a completely new sense. Dr. Miguel Nicolelis said the advance, reported in the Nature Communications Journal this week, was just a prelude to a major breakthrough on a brain-to-brain interface, which will be announced in another paper next month. Speaking at the annual meeting, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Boston on Sunday, he described the mystery work as something no one has dreamed could be done. The second paper is being kept secret until it is published, but Dr. Nicolelis's comments raise the prospect of an implant which could allow one animal's brain to interact directly with another. In the first study, rats wore an infrared detector on their head, which was connected to the electrodes in part of their brain, which governs touch. When one of the ultraviolet light sources in their cage was switched on, the rats initially began rubbing their whiskers, indicating that they felt as though they were touching the invisible light. After a month of training, they learned to link the new sensation with the light sources and were able to find which one was switched on with 100% accuracy. A monkey has since been taught to perform the same task. The study demonstrates that a part of the brain which is designed to process one sense can interpret other types of sensory information, researchers said. It means that, in theory, someone who is blind because of damage to their visual cortex could regain their sight using an implant or a prosthesis in another part of the brain, said Dr. Nicolelis. What we did here was to demonstrate that we could create new sense in rats by allowing them to touch infrared light that mammals cannot detect normally. The nerves were responding to both touch and infrared light at the same time. This shows that the adult brain can acquire new capabilities that have never been experienced by the animal before. This also suggested in the future you could use prosthetic devices to restore sensory modalities that have been lost, such as a camera delivering visual information, probably simple at first, like black and white or red and white, to humans who have lost their eyesight. The study is part of an international effort to build a whole-body suit, which allows paralyzed people to walk again using their brain to control the device's movements. It also is the precursor to exoskeletons, which can be used to greatly multiply the strength and agility of someone who, might need that, such as a soldier. So it's just kind of interesting, the stuff that's going on out there. Kind of interesting and also frightening. I don't know. Space tourism, sometimes it almost seems to disappear into the desert. Conceived as a conjuring trick of architecture and topography, Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic Gateway to Space rises in a sinuous curve from the New Mexico dust, its steel surfaces weathered into a red-brown mirage on the horizon. The route that the package tour astronauts of tomorrow will take through the building has been meticulously devised by the architects of Foster and Partners to foreshadow the journey they will take into space. That's kind of cool that you can become a space tourist and, well, spend that money that, you want to go up into space at 100,000 feet or 150,000 feet, be weightless for a little while, and then come back. Tickets are selling for a measly 130,000 pounds, but they keep selling. At the start of last year, actor Ashton Kutcher became the 500th person to sign up, joining cosmologist Stephen Hawking, a designer Philippe Starck, and Dallas star Victoria Principal on the list of passengers. But not all the celebrities so far reported to be planning sightseeing trips in space have reserved tickets. Virgin has been discreet about the full list, all it will reveal is that in the interests of democracy, Branson has insisted that no one gets a complimentary Branson, has insisted that no one gets a complimentary ride, no matter how famous they are. Also in the news, and this really doesn't have a lot to do with science, but it does have to do with maybe some of the forces that are at work out there we don't really hear about in the news. Al-Qaeda, I'm sure everyone has heard about that. One of the things that we find from time to time as we make our raids or blow the heck out of stuff and we go sifting through the remains is evidence. But Al-Qaeda is pretty cagey. That is to say, when they know the drones are coming or they know that an airstrike is coming, they'll scatter. And in their hurry to flee last month, Al-Qaeda fighters left behind a crucial document. Tucked under a pile of papers and trash is a confidential letter spelling out the terror network's strategy for conquering northern Mali and reflecting internal discord over how to rule the region. The document is an unprecedented window into the terrorist operation, indicating that Al-Qaeda predicted the military intervention that would dislodge it in January and recognized its own vulnerability. The letter also shows a sharp division within Al-Qaeda's Africa chapter over how quickly and how strictly to apply Islamic law, with its senior commander expressing dismay over the whipping of women and the destruction of Timbuktu's ancient monuments. This is something both of which Al-Qaeda loves and plans to do. It moreover leaves no doubt that despite a temporary withdrawal into the desert, Al-Qaeda plans to operate in the region over the long haul and is willing to make short-term concessions on ideology to gain the allies it acknowledges it needs. Quite a frightening document, my friends. It's not something that you want to practice, with which you want to practice appeasement. Appeasement. Definition, feeding your friends to the alligator so it will eat you last. Appeasement. Look it up. By the way, what takes place in thunderstorms on Earth is most likely a smaller version of large-scale phenomenon. This is pretty fascinating. Hans Alvain says, I have always believed that astrophysics should be the extrapolation of laboratory physics, that we must begin from the present universe and work our way backwards to progressively more remote and uncertain epochs. Previous picture of the day, electromagnetic fields beneath thunderstorms increase to 10,000 volts per meter because the storms and the Earth act like plates of a capacitor. You know, builds up the charge on one side of the plates up in the cloud itself, sometimes up to 50,000 feet high. And when that bolt decides to discharge, of course, it's reached millions of volts of potential between the cloud and Earth. An ion path opens, usually extending up from Earth to the cloud, sort of like Benjamin Franklin flying his wet string up into the cloud to create a path for the lightning bolt to follow. Stored electricity from the surrounding environment kind of follows that ion path back to Earth. A wind of charged particles blows toward the developing storm. You've felt it sometimes, especially if you're sitting on a mountain, pulling neutral air molecules along with the current, creating these powerful updrafts that can occasionally rise into the stratosphere, way up above 50,000 feet. Once the storm reaches a critical threshold, the stored energy is released as a lightning bolt. You see it, you know, out here in the east all the time. Out west in California, you don't often see lightning bolts. You just kind of see the sky light up there. It's not like out in the Midwest where you actually see a thunderstorm, you know, lash its bolts down to the ground. Thunderstorms act like particle accelerators, launching massive discharges upward to space as well as downward to the ground. The upward strokes are known as red sprites and blue jets, but they're not as easy to detect since they only last a millisecond and they are at very high altitude. Now we have satellites that watch for them, but you can see them from a passenger jet if you're flying high enough and you're far enough away from the storm. You don't want to get too close to them because they do emit gamma radiation, and so it can be a little hazardous to be up there. The temperature of gases in the cluster core is often measured at 100 million degrees Kelvin. Researchers think that electrons accelerated by shock waves traveling through the center gas generate the intense X-rays of these types of bolts that go up into space. Shock waves are said to be created when two galaxy clusters collide and merge. We've seen the same thing in space. The European Space Agency International Gamma Ray Astrophysics Laboratory, called Integral, was launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome on October 17th, way back in 2002. It is the first space-based observatory that can be used to simultaneously study objects in gamma ray, X-ray, and visible light. That's why it's got the name Integral. Of course, X-rays are far too intense to be generated from hot gas in the cluster, so they have to be generated from these shock waves. Nobel laureate Hans Alvain maintained that double layers are a unique celestial object and that the intense X-ray and gamma ray sources could be due to these double layers shorting out and exploding. Double layers can accelerate charged particles up to enormous energies in a variety of frequencies, forming plasma beams. If the double layer breaks the circuit, then the double layer may explode, drawing electricity from the entire circuit and discharging more energy than was contained in the double layer. It's kind of like an ionospheric breakdown would be if we saw such a thing on Earth. It would be devastating, to be sure. Maybe not life-ending, except in the general area of the bolt itself. It'd be very similar to the shock wave that was generated by the recent meteorite that struck in Russia. By the way, I read a couple of interesting stories on that. Of course, we've heard all the conspiracy theories about that, that it was a satellite, that it was something that the U.S. had launched, that it was a mothership. We've seen several pieces where we've seen pieces ejected off the front of this meteorite in infrared, and people have claimed that these were smaller ships leaving the mothership. We even have a received and translated transmission where one of the pieces, pretty good size, crashed through the ice, leaving a crater, about 60 feet across, or a hole in the ice to the water. And this particular transmission, which was translated, said, we cannot find the craft. So I don't know exactly why they would say that unless somebody thought they saw a craft go crashing through the ice that came off of this thing. And some observations were made that the meteor as it was traveling, or meteoroid as it was traveling through our atmosphere, was traveling parallel to the ground, and that most of the time meteors have a steeper angle. They just come blasting in, you know, to the surface and make a crater. Very fortunately, that was not the case this time. The meteoroid came into the atmosphere becoming a meteorite when it hit the ground, came in at a glancing angle, and so it appeared to be parallel to the ground, even though it was in a descending pattern. It didn't completely bounce off the atmosphere. Some of the meteoroid actually hit the ground, becoming meteorite, and some of it did not. But coming in as fast as it did, approximately 30,000 miles an hour, that's many times the speed of sound, and multiple people recorded hearing 9 booms. That'd be 9 sonic booms, one on top of the other, and that the shockwave from that is actually what caused the windows and doors and damage to the buildings in the town in Russia. I doubt very seriously it was a mothership coming into the atmosphere. It certainly wasn't the only one that we had in a series of days, the most recent of which I believe was yesterday. We have had fireballs in the sky. I maintain that we have entered the galactic plane, that these new comets, or new meteoroids are going to be and asteroids are going to be scattered along the way. We have not seen them before. They have brand new numbers, either late 2012. Some of them will be 2013 because we're entering a gravel road in the galaxy. We have in our own solar system evidence of what is called a black axiom. A black axiom is an astronomical phenomenon that occurs when a solar system passes through a point in space where there is a lot of particulate matter. It can be high energy or low energy. It could be gravel. It can be sand. It can be dust. In most cases, it's iron. In most cases, it's black, hence the name black axiom. Slowly rotating bodies that revolve slowly on their axis are going to get half-coated, or maybe just a little over half-coated as we pass through the cloud. Fast-rotating bodies are going to get a more uniform coating on all the sides. Slow-rotating body would be like our moon, which revolves once every 28 days on its axis, happens to be exactly the same amount of time as it takes for it to go one orbit around the Earth. So hence the moon phase is 28 days. It's revolution on its own axis is 28 days, hence the same side of the moon always faces Earth. The side that faces Earth has been coated with the black axiom, knocking its albedo down to 10%. The side that faces away from Earth, no black coating, and has an albedo of 60%. That means that 60% of the sun's energy that strikes the moon reflects back out into space on the far side of the moon, which would make the far side of the moon not the dark side of the moon. The side that faces us, only 10% of its light reflects back out into space. So actually, it's the darker side of the moon. And you can imagine how bright it would be if the light side of the moon was facing the Earth during a full moon. You'd probably have to wear sunglasses. There are also several large asteroids that are slow rotating on their own axes, and they have been observed as being half coated with black. So this is a solar system wide event that occurs approximately every 25 to 26,000 years, which, as it turns out, is exactly the term of the precession of the equinoxes, which means that as our solar system revolves around the other solar system, its sister star, which evidently is Sirius, the star Sirius, our sun is a binary sun with that star. And as we revolve around each other, we pass through this galactic plane about every 26,000 years. And I'm an amateur astronomer that maintains that this black axiom is responsible for such things as the Carolina Lakes, the iron bead deposit on the Atlantic seafloor, and several teardrop-shaped craters across Russia and the Siberian desert. All in the same path, my friends, all in the same path. The Carolina Lakes have ancient forests that are laid flat by ancient meteorite strikes, and they were all in one event. We didn't get hit, and then 10,000 years later hit again, and then 10,000 years hit again. It was all one event. So, a gravel road. Also, we made mention of the currency wars that apparently have begun, because Japan's aggressive attempts to spur on its struggling economy were set to escape censure from the G20 nations today, as bickering in Moscow kept alive fears of a currency war. Now, most of you alive do not know what a currency war is. The last time we had one was in 1931. Multiple nations bailed from the gold standard in order to grab control of their own currencies, manipulate the value of those currencies, giving their own nations more value on the global market. In other words, they were able to export enough to enrich their own nations, offset their trade balances, as it were. And that devaluation of those currencies caused a currency war. In fact, it could be said that 20 years after the formation of the Federal Reserve, which was specifically designed to be able to capture and control the value of currency. Because it has been said by the Rothschilds, you give me control of the currency of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws. Well, we're seeing that come to its fruition, I'm afraid. 80 years of currency manipulation globally by the Federal Reserve and now the International Monetary Fund have finally shown what they can really do. Finance ministers at the G20 gathering are understood to have pulled back from the explicit criticism of Japan, whose Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has embarked on a huge program of monetary and fiscal stimulus to jumpstart the world's third largest economy out of its third recession in 5 years. The currency market was thrown into turmoil this week after the G7, that's the United States, Japan, Germany, Britain, France, Canada, and Italy, issued a joint statement warning against using domestic policy to target currencies. But the show of unity was immediately shattered by off-the-record briefings against Japan, which needs a weaker yen to help fuel its export-driven economy. Watch out for cheaper Toyotas, Hondas, Nissans, and other Japanese brands. European Central Bank President Mario Draghi yesterday labeled the behind-the-scenes briefing as inappropriate, fruitless, and self-defeating. International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde and Russia's Deputy Finance Minister Sergei Storchak also denied the existence of currency wars, labeling recent swings in the yen as market reaction to exclusively internal decision-making. Nonsense. And it was so well known and so well read. I'm just going to give you a piece of proof here that just blows your mind. Let's see here. Here we go. The balance of power now rests with Japan, according to the bank, as Japan's policymakers' more dovish approach looks set to bring the world a step closer to a currency war. The Bank of Japan doubled its inflation target to 2% in January and made an open-ended commitment to buying assets from next year. This follows a leadership change with new Prime Minister Shinzo Abe openly calling for aggressive monetary stimulus from the country's central bank. Does that sound familiar? It does, doesn't it? This move, Morgan Stanley said, is a game changer as Japan tries to invigorate its stagnating economy. If a weaker yen is an important pillar of the strategy to make this export-oriented economy more competitive again, it brings into the picture something that was missing from earlier interactions among central banks of the advanced economics, what's called competitive depreciation. Why is this so important? Because it sparks a currency war. It means that currency trading will become very, very aggressive. The experience of the 1930s suggests to us that such large currency crises are likely triggered by domestic issues, that they do create distinct winners and losers. Emerging market policymakers are already gearing up to make sure they remain on the winning side. But, you know, the balance of power rests with Japan unless you have inside information and you can make your bet early and big. George Soros, the man that was single-handedly responsible for crushing the Bank of England, absolutely broke them and made himself a billionaire by hedging and manipulating money, has made almost $1 billion, with a B, since November. People, it's only February. I can imagine how happy you would be if you made a cool billion from November to February from bets that the yen would tumble, according to a person close to the billionaire's $24 billion family office. The Japanese wager helped the firm return about 10% last year and 5% so far this year, said the person, who was asked not to be named because the firm is private. They're not publicly traded, in other words. The yen has weakened 17% versus the dollar since about the start of the fourth quarter of last year, the worst performance over a similar period since 1985. George Soros, founder of Soros Fund Management, LLC, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. This was January 25th of just last month, just a few days ago. George Soros, founder of Soros Fund Management, billionaire investor George Soros talks about the European sovereign debt crisis, inflation risk, and his Open Society Foundations. He speaks with Francine Lacroix at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. Of course, the yen slumped. I wonder how he even knew that was going to happen. Scott Bissett, chief investment officer at New York-based Soros Fund Management, also has 10% of the firm's initially managed portfolio betting on the rising shares in Japan, said the person. Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 stock index has jumped about 28% since the end of September. That's one way out of a recession. Bissett worked for Soros in 1992 when Soros and his chief strategist Stan Druckenmiller made $10 billion off a bet that the Bank of England would be forced to devalue the pound. That wager netted them $1 billion and broke the bank. So what are the indicators that this is happening? Well, come on, people. You know that when the Nikkei starts up that the Dow is going to follow. You listen to the reports the night before that the Nikkei goes up 2% or 3% or 10%. You know darn good and well you can buy a call option and you're going to make money the next day on the Dow. That's the way it happens. So when you see a Dow that's screaming up to record heights, it's not because those companies that make up the Dow actually have profits, actually have value. In fact, there are many companies in that have lost money almost every year for the last 10 years. Well, how can your stock go up if your company is doing so badly? It's because the stock itself is manipulated by market makers. What's a market maker? They're rumor mongers. That's what they do. They publish stories here and there about different government reports, different customers buying products, different breakthroughs being made, different special buys being made on supplies, changes in management, like adding somebody that's really famous or letting go somebody that's been a real problem or laying off a bunch of people, and thus the stock goes up. There are companies that have actually never made a profit that are booked. That is to say, their market value is somewhere around $1.5 billion. Now, I don't want to tell you who these companies are because it's ridiculous to even consider it. But the other indicator, beside the Dow going up to screaming heights, is to watch what the hedge does. What's the hedge? No, it's not that row of plants between your house and the neighbor's house. A hedge is like a safety net. It's an ability to cover risk on something else. For you and I, our hedge is normally precious metals. We buy silver, we buy gold, we buy platinum, we buy rhodium, palladium. These are precious metals that seem to hold their value. Gold is probably the most stable with respect to hard assets. That is to say, gold will buy the same amount of land today as it would buy in 1850. Gold doesn't change value. It's the money that changes the value, but the gold stays the same value relative to hard assets. Silver, on the other hand, is quite manipulated. There's not as much silver as there is gold. I know, you'd think, what do you mean? Silver more rare than gold? Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was more plentiful and it was more mined. But you got to remember, silver got consumed. Got turned into coins, got turned into electric circuits, got turned into switching contacts and all kinds of, you know, industrial purposes like solder and coatings and alloys. You don't use gold for those kinds of things except for electric contacts every now and then, but you don't use it for solder. You don't use it for, you know, common industrial things. We use it in antiseptics. We use it in lenses. We use it in film, all kinds of stuff. The point is that most of the silver, about 90% of it that's been mined, has been used. And so the silver reserves as ingots or bars or collecting coins, they went out of production probably in 1995 or 1998. The ingots and bars and things that you're buying today with respect for the newly minted stuff, 2012, 2013, and that's not that much, is second and third hand silver. It's been handed around. So why is silver going to be different than gold? Right now, silver's down around $29 an ounce. I almost dropped my microphone here. What do you mean $29 an ounce? That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Gold was close to $2,000. Now it's down to about $1,600 to $1,800. It's still fluctuating up and down. But silver, although it went from $4 a share up to about $34 an ounce, $4 an ounce up to $34 an ounce, almost to $37 an ounce, is now back down to $29. Well, this is something that we predicted exactly that it would happen this way, that silver would begin a slow slide, may even go down to $20 an ounce before this takes hold. Why is it doing that? I will tell you why it's doing that. Because Morgan Stanley has the largest vault of silver in this country. And it's not all their silver. It belongs to a lot of people, but it's in their vault. So Morgan Stanley can be long on silver. That is to say, they can bet that the price of silver is going to go up because they own it. They've got it. But how does that justify Morgan Stanley also controlling several hundred thousand short contracts on silver? Ah, now you begin to understand. The primary factors mandating a silver accident are excessive naked short selling and leasing. I've explained to you what naked shorting is, but I'm going to explain it to you briefly again. Silver has the largest short position that's ever existed in anything. This is the key component to the coming silver accident. The reason the price is going down is because Morgan Stanley is making money on it going down, because they have hundreds of thousands of naked short contracts on silver. They want to get paid for that. The total naked short positions in silver measure into the billions of ounces and towers over the real world supplies. We don't have billions of ounces of silver. It doesn't exist. But the naked short positions do. This combined short position includes the COMEX, all other exchanges, forward selling and leasing, the cumulative issuance of unbacked silver, bank certificates, unallocated storage programs, and even pool accounts. No other commodity has such a huge naked short position. In other words, all these holders of these short contracts cannot afford silver going up in price. It is basically this bloated short position that's at the heart of the coming silver accident. It is this same excessive short position that guarantees a financial windfall for you if you buy hard silver and own it. A naked short sale is the sale of something you don't own. It's like you selling a Mercedes-Benz, a brand new 7 Series Mercedes-Benz for $10,000. Who's not going to buy it? Who is not going to buy that? You don't own the Mercedes. You're only selling a Mercedes you don't own, and somebody is buying that piece of paper from you. They never actually get the Mercedes. They only have the short contract. While common in financial markets, more than 99% of the world's population will never sell short anything in their lifetimes. We don't want to. We want to sell for a profit. Why would you buy a house for $500,000 and then sell it for $250,000? Friends, you cannot make up for it in volume with that unless you sell the house you don't own. Then you get to put the $250,000 straight into your pocket. You just never deliver the house. That's because it's an unusual and it's an unnatural financial transaction. unbridled short selling can artificially depress the price. Of course it does, because you're constantly selling it for less than it's worth. That is why we have restrictions on short selling that date back to the great stock market crash of 1929. But since Obama has been in office, there has not been one, zero, zip, nada, not one single prosecution of anybody doing it. It's illegal. In commodities, there must be a short for every long on the futures contract. Regulations are supposed to preclude excessive long and short speculation via speculation position limits. But these regulations have been abandoned in COMEX silver, despite the efforts of many of us to correct that. Naked short selling is illegal. It's called failure to deliver. Come on, I spent my $10,000. Where's my Mercedes? Well, I'm sorry, but we're not able to deliver the Mercedes. That's called a failure to deliver. The same thing goes with stock. If you have an account in Fidelity, if you have an account in Citgo, if you have an account in Mass Mutual or Morgan Stanley or Chase, and you buy stock, you don't actually get the stock certificate. The only thing you get is you get to buy it at that price. You will never see the stock certificate. You have no idea if it exists or not. If it goes up, you can sell it. They'll go buy it at the cheaper price, and they'll make a profit off it just like you. If it goes down in price, you'll lose your money, and they make money on the short contract, and they never own the stock. So they never have to report the income. There's one other aspect about short selling that is important to grasp. Whereas the word sale means closure or finality, in all the billions of daily world business and financial transactions, you know what it is, where you're, whether you're buying a pastry or you're buying a truck. A short sale is always an open or an incomplete transaction. It never takes place. A normal sale marks the end of a transaction. A short sale makes the beginning of a transaction. A short sale must be completed at some point in some way. There is no exception to this rule. Either the short sale is repurchased and closed out, or that which has been sold short is actually delivered and the open short sale is closed. But if you can't deliver, guess what you have to do? You have to go buy it. And then you have to sell it, which means if you push that short sale contract on that Mercedes, the person that sold you that Mercedes has to go buy that Mercedes. For how much? Ooh, $75,000. And then they got to sell it to you for $10,000. You can't make up for that in volume either. It means that person's going broke. Precisely because all short sales must be closed out guarantees a silver accident. What do I mean by that? Well, when I say that silver has the largest short position in history, I'm also saying that silver has the largest number of incomplete transactions in history. Forget for the moment the manipulative and depressing effect this monumental short position has had on the price, down to $29. It should be around $350 right now. All short sales must be closed out in some way. With silver, could it be delivering the silver? I think so. Against the billions of ounces of silver sold short, which don't exist, how much do we have to deliver to actually close out these incomplete transactions? Oh, you're going to cry when you hear this. In the COMEX warehouses, there's 100 million ounces. Oops, that's a little bit short. That represents most of the known silver bullion in the world. But it's mostly owned by investors other than the short sellers. They don't even own the silver. They only have the vault. Maybe there are a billion ounces of silver in the world, in coins, small bars, silverware, but that's not eligible for delivery against the silver short position of billions of ounces. With an S, billions. There might be a billion ounces in the whole world in all those forms. But not only is all the world silver in existence woefully insufficient to cover the monstrous short position, but most of this insufficient quantity isn't even owned by the people that are selling the short positions. That's why I've made such a big deal about the uniqueness of a silver short position that's larger than existing world inventories. That's why I keep telling you, take a little bit of your paycheck each week or each month and buy a couple silver bars. Buy some silver eagles. That's probably the most well-known form. They're 1 full ounce. It's going to cost you $29 to $35 to buy one. They're expensive. Get yourself 300 or 400 ounces of silver over the next year and a half. And when silver goes shooting up to $300, $400, $500 an ounce, you're going to be able to buy yourself a house. That's called being long on silver. While there is no way to determine when silver shorts will spook and rush to cover, time is not on their side. They must try at some point to buy back and cover the silver they can't possibly deliver. And that means the price is going to go up. It is not important to know in advance what the actual trigger for the silver accident will be. All you need to know is that with the critical and long-term physical deficit in silver, the short-selling charade must end. It has no choice. Since we can't determine when, don't focus on the timing. Focus on the inevitability. Don't plan on buying that car in the next 90 days with your silver or cash. But you are going to be able to buy it. I can guarantee you that. From 2000 to 2004, the silver price averaged between $4 and $5. Since then, the silver price has been $6, $7, usually $8. Now it's $29. But does that increase mean the price has finally responded to the law of supply and demand? Absolutely not. Normally, a price increase of 50% or 100% in commodities should be sufficient to balance any consumption deficit, but not for silver. That's because the consumption deficit in silver is unlike any other commodity deficit. Silver has been in a structural deficit, stretching back for more than half a century. And you can't undo damage of 60 years with a 50 or 100% gain. Sorry, folks, it's going to take about a 2 to 3,000% gain. There is zero evidence that production or consumption has been impacted by the price or that the silver deficit has been cured. There has been no worldwide rush to find new silver mines in response to higher prices. Silver may have increased in price, but there has been zero effect on the near-term production increases or substitutions in demand. Nobody's out there digging silver mines, people. The first prerequisite for the coming silver accident is very much intact. However, it takes more than a bullish supply and demand equation to cause a violent price event. Bullish fundamentals point to higher prices, but not necessarily a price accident. It is the silver short position. I say again, in spades, this is the precursor for this accident. When it occurs, you are going to be the winner if you own silver. So I recommend, most people recommend that you put some money in metals. Now, most people are intimidated by the price of gold. Can't go out and buy very much gold. Even $2,000 isn't going to get you enough to make but a couple of rings. But $2,000 is a lot of silver. That's a lot of silver. And $2,000 invested in silver now, if it goes up 10 times or 15 times, that's anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000. That's enough to buy a new car. So you put yourself $2,000 away now and you wait. And when the accident occurs and gold goes up to $300, $400 an ounce, sell your silver and buy your car. That's how it'll happen. Drone Wars update. Real quick, We now have robot helicopters out in the war zones. Obama says, this is something I've struggled with throughout my presidency. I know this is really going to blow your mind. We've never had a president say anything even close to this, not even all the way back to Washington. And we have presidential comments all over the place. Some of them are, you know, immortalized by how wise they are and how profound they are. Statements about evil empires and statement about, you know, different things going to the moon, inspirational things. But we've never had a president say this. I have to preclude this statement with this. Obama says, this is something I've struggled with throughout my presidency. The problem is that I'm the president of the United States. I'm not the emperor of the United States. My job is to execute laws that are passed. Thank goodness. No president needs to say something like this. In any presidency, I've said on this program for many years, ask yourself, is the man there for the presidency, or is the presidency there for the man? If you can answer that question, you can decide who needs to be president. Here's what we got. Drone wars update. A robotic helicopter has been quietly busy resupplying Marines on the battlefield and in remote locations in Afghanistan. Truck resupply convoys and their military escorts are frequently the target of improvised explosive devices and insurgent attacks. By replacing the traditional truck convoy, the unmanned K-MAX has already reduced the risk to U.S. forces by thousands of hours. K-MAX's airdrops provide a safe, low-cost supply delivery method to get important medical equipment and food to troops. December 17, 2011, K-MAX became the first unmanned helicopter to fly a resupply mission, delivering approximately 3,500 pounds of cargo to Afghanistan. With American towns and states scrambling to ban them, a new base planned for Africa and debate over how President Obama can use them to eliminate terrorists. Some wonder whether drones should be operated at all. K-MAX is one reason to rethink such sweeping generalizations. Yes, I think there are some positive things that can be done with robots. Surveillance of Americans, weaponizing drones and sending them against Americans in America is not one of them. While, unmanned helicopters is the result of a partnership between Kamen Group and Lockheed Martin, combining Kamen's high-altitude, rugged, heavy-lift K-1200 airframe with Lockheed Martin's mission management and control systems. While it supports a pilot, K-MAX can fly by itself, day or night, and at higher altitudes, with a larger payload than any other rotary-winged unmanned craft, according to Lockheed Martin. With its four-hook carousel, K-MAX can supply multiple locations in one flight and handle as much as 4,500 pounds of cargo per mission. The sleek-looking unmanned helicopter features a design emphasizing simplicity, dropping a tail rotor to alleviate stress to the frame. The 52-foot-long helicopter travels at a top speed of about 115 miles an hour with a 48-foot wingspan. K-MAX has a number of other firsts, including the largest payload airdropped via sling load from a helicopter, 4,400 pounds, and the highest altitude flown, 10,000 feet. In May of last year, the aircraft performed a historic hot hookup, enabling personnel to attach cargo to the unmanned aircraft while in hover mode. The hot hookup continues to be regularly used to give K-MAX cargo to carry on the return flight, further increasing its efficiency. In other words, it never really has to land. Slated to remain in theater through March of 2013, K-MAX's deployment has been extended twice so far, with an option to extend deployment until next September. So Cyberdyne Systems now has a platform, vertical takeoff and landing, or hover, that they can use. In civilian space, K-MAX also has a range of applications from helicopter logging and power line construction to ski lift installations and even remote construction sites. K-MAX has enormous potential for emergency response missions too, ranging from firefighting and disaster relief to search and rescue. Certainly supported for firefighting. We always feel a sense of loss and offer our condolences for any firefighters that are killed during the extremely hazardous air fighting of forest fires. You don't realize the strain that an aircraft goes through going down, scooping up water out of the sea, taking off again, banking over the trees, and then dropping that water. The constant waiting and unwaiting of that frame in short succession is very, very stressful to the airframe. Let's see. I was going to talk about near-Earth objects, but I think we're seeing that already in the news, so I'm not going to cover that. I don't have a whole lot of time. A lot of you have read in the news that Vladimir Putin, arguably the wealthiest, most powerful man in the world, is endangering the global economy by abusing its dollar monopoly. He's not talking about it, folks. He's doing it. He's betting on it big time. Not only has Putin made Russia the world's largest oil producer, he's also made it the biggest gold buyer. His central bank has added 570 metric tons of the metal in the past decade, a quarter more than runner-up China, according to the International Monetary Fund data compiled by Bloomberg. The added gold is almost triple the weight of the Statue of Liberty. Russia's prime minister, let's see, what a cagey guy, so bold. The more gold a country has, the more sovereign it will have, more sovereignty it will have if there's a cataclysm with the dollar, the euro, the pound, and any other reserve currency. Mr. Fedorov, a lawmaker for Putin's United Russia Party in the lower house of parliament, said in a telephone interview in Moscow, gold, coveted by Russian rulers since Tsar Nicholas II and the Bolshevik leader whose forces assassinated him, Vladimir Lenin, has soared almost 400% in the period of Putin's purchases. Central banks around the world have printed money to escape the global financial crisis, sapping investor appetite for dollars and euros and setting off a scramble for safety. In 1998, the year Russia defaulted on $40 billion of domestic debt, it took as many as 28 barrels of crude to buy an ounce of gold, Bloomberg's data shows. That ratio tumbled by 11.5 by the time Putin first came to power a year later, and in 2005 after it touched 6.5, less than half of what it is now, the president told the central bank to buy, buy, buy. And that's what they've been doing. Well, how does this affect you? What does this mean? How do you get yourself up and about and take care of yourself? A lot of you are just barely making ends meet, and I understand that. And there's more to life than money, but that's easy for people to say who have money. But I can tell you from personal experience that once you reach a plateau, a threshold, a point at which you had set that goal when you were younger, and you're walking around the house or walking around your spread or thinking about what you've accomplished, something happens to you, something amazing if you reach this point. And that is that you realize, is this all there is to life? Is this everything it was cracked up to be? I've accomplished all this. I've graduated college. I've bought my house. I've had my kids. They're all grown and gone. What? I don't want to retire. Who wants to go retire and play golf with a bunch of old people? There's been a phenomenon happening out there, and it's happening in all stages of life, not just the successful, but Those that have had one failure after another have realized it as well. It's a push for simplification. People are moving their businesses back into their homes. They're involving their families in their daily life. They are selling the big office buildings. They're backing out of the trappings of big business and the trappings of wealth. They're downsizing their homes or moving into condos. They're giving up the expensive automobiles. Well, okay, maybe not that. They like the expensive automobiles. Everybody does. And hopefully they keep doing that because we need a strong auto industry. But they're simplifying their lives. They're getting themselves out of debt. They're letting those credit cards go. They're cutting up the Sears card, the Kohl's card, the Penny's card. They're starting to more rely more on the real time wages that they have, reducing their debt levels, reducing their exposure levels, reducing the complexity of their life with respect to how many hours do I have to work this week to pay my bills. You may have less, and that's part of the simplification too. I mean, I've visited my colleagues out in Phoenix or LA or Seattle or New York. And when I visit them and they ask me, I say, well, yeah, I'm out of debt. I've been out of debt for probably 8 years now. And they have no idea what that feels like. They've never been out of debt in their whole lives. They've had a revolving or an installment payment their entire adult lives. And that's what I mean by simplification. If you look at the stuff that you have in your house, the furniture, the big screen TV, the car, the bass boat, the camping property, toys laying around the house. Think about all that stuff that you're making payments on. Now, if you own it, that's fine. If you own it, you own it. But if you're making payments on it and you're realizing, you know what, I probably have about 20%, 15%, 10%. Of my income that I can consider disposable. I might be making $75,000 a year, but how much of that is disposable? I mean, how much of that, if you were to save up 3 weeks' pay without making a payment on a bill, what do you think you could go buy? Well, you could probably buy something that's worth $6,000 or $7,000, right? That's a pretty substantial purchase, but you'd pay cash, but you can't. Why? Because 80% of your pay is going to pay a bill. And that bill is going to last for a long time. Not just a house payment and a car payment. I mean the other stuff. The vacation you took last summer on your Visa card that you're still paying on. The couch and chair and coffee table that you bought from the furniture store that you're still making payments on. That kind of stuff. That kind of burden on you is the slavery of the 21st century. It's the slavery to debt that brings everybody down, that makes them work jobs they hate, that makes them do things and give up things that upset them, that bring them down, that don't give them any fulfillment. If you find yourself punctuating your life with summer vacations, or you're punctuating your life with the three times a year when you get a fifth paycheck, in a month, you need to simplify. You need to rethink the way you're doing stuff. If you've never bought clothes for your kids at a yard sale, you may need to rethink the way you're living your life. One of the reasons we talk about the science that we do is to open your mind, is to let you know the possibilities. Not just quantum possibilities, I mean real possibilities about what's going on out there. Who's doing what? Who's manipulating what? And are you being manipulated? Are you financially being manipulated because the bank is trading your mortgage all over the planet? Are you financially being manipulated because you're in debt and so you belong to them and they can tell you what to do and what not to do? Or you have a job that you don't like doing. So you turn your brain off for 40 hours a week so that you can do your job and bring the money home and be responsible for your family. And you're getting older and you're getting slower and you're getting fatter and you're losing your dreams because you're doing that. Is that the way you want to live? I mean, I'm asking the question. And you need to ask yourself that question. You look at the things that are going on out there. You look at the ideas that you have that you've never acted on. You remember that piece that I read in the opening hour? If you missed it, please, please go back and read it. It's the difference between the successful and the not successful. I'm not going to say the haves and have-nots. That's ridiculous. There are lots of haves, and they're in debt up to their eyeballs. And there are have-nots, but they have no debt. Now, who do you think is happier? Yeah, I'm telling you, money might give you a little bit of happiness, but debt does not. The appearance of money, the lust for money, that brings misery. But the kind of success that you want, that you dream about, only comes by the sweat of your brow. Maybe a little bit of luck, but I think you kind of make your own luck. It's like playing pool. If the balls aren't rolling, they're never going to go in the hole. You can sit there and stare at them all day long, but if you don't stand up there and take a strike with that cue, nothing's going to happen. That's just the way it is. Now, somebody asked me the other day why we were so significant in the universe. As humans, I mean, as individuals, as a race, maybe, we could say we're significant in the universe because we're so diverse, we're so amazing in the things that we can do, both for the greater good and, you know, even for destruction and greed. We certainly see that. We certainly see a great desire by certain factions of the world trying to force their ideology on someone else. And I don't mean by proselytizing, I mean with the sword. But as individuals, are we significant? Are we noticed by God? Are we significant as individual consciousnesses in the universe? I maintain that we are. That's why I say on the website, and I often say as I close this program, to remember, you are Source. Your observation, not only of yourself, but the people around you, definitely has an effect on the universe. Is it measurable? Maybe. Is it statistically significant? Maybe. But I can guarantee you're having that effect. I can guarantee this, the null hypothesis is absolutely true. That is to say, it is impossible that you have no effect on the universe. Therefore, everything you do does have an effect on the universe. The love that you share with other people, that you express to others, the care, the genuineness, reaching out to someone to listen or to help, definitely affects the universe. Also, shutting people out, disrespecting them, taking advantage of them, that also has their effects. Now, a lot of this has our own perspective, just our own perspective. This is the way I see it kind of idea. And I've always maintained that there are three different complementarities to this. A complementarity is a truth on either side of the equation. There is the way you observe yourself. There is the way that others around you observe you. And then there is the way you truly are in the universe. Compared to what? Well, maybe compared to an outside observer. Let's call that observer God. God would say, Brooks, I know who you are. I've always known who you are. I can say, well, I know myself. I know who I am. I know who I was. I know who I want to be. And then there are the people around me that go, yeah, I know Brooks Agnew. That guy, well, you just fill in the blank. Some of it's good. Most of it's good. Some of it's bad. I have my bad traits too. Somewhere, people would say, somewhere in lies the truth. Well, they are all true. As Niels Bohr once said, these are complementarities. Oh, you can lie to yourself. It's done all the time. We're seeing it right now in politics. folks. You want to see somebody lying to himself and lying to everybody else around him? But just turn on the news. Won't take long. You'll see it. But there's a truth in that nonetheless. The fact that you can fake it till you make it, or somehow you realize that no matter what you do, no matter what you say, no matter who you kill, no matter who you starve, no matter who you steal from, you're still here. You're still here. They can't fire you. I mean, they can make you quit, but they can't fire you. It's never been done. It's not going to be done. Why? Well, because you're part of something bigger than yourself. When you're in that position, you're part of a political party. The party can't take a blow like that. And so it supports a loser. It supports an insane person, even though they know that that person is a loser and insane. Why? Because they wear your uniform, and you got to support them, and you got to stick by them, and you got to go catch all the spears for that person. But not all of us live in that kind of situation. I'm dead serious, people. At your work, if you stood up and started doing crazy stuff, if you claimed credit for something you didn't do, if you started a rumor about somebody in management, you're going to be fired. You're going to be gone out of there. You're going to be working, cutting grass somewhere if you can't get a handle on that. That is truth, and you cannot get away from that. So how significant are you in the universe? You're very significant. And I am amazed. In fact, I'm humbled to the dust. The walks of life that I travel in business, I meet a lot of engineers. I meet a lot of managers. I meet a lot of floor workers. I meet a lot of buyers and a lot of sellers. And I'm amazed and I am humbled to the dust of the aware people that I meet. Now, they're not walking around with rainbow-colored hair and tattoos up to their earlobes. They're not walking around with outward signs of this at all. Some of them are in church every single Sunday. Some of them are grandparents and have grandkids and live ordinary lives, as stable as you can imagine. But their understanding of their eternality and their effect on society and the universe is profound. I've met people in overalls and three-piece suits, and they have an awareness, and it's more widespread than you can imagine. Why do you think that is? It's because of you. It's because you're listening to programs like this, and you're getting this information. You're reading books. You're listening to interviews. You're listening to stations like this one. And you're learning these truths. You're learning how these forces are working in and around you and how you are interacting with them. And somehow you're sharing that with them. And the more bold you can be in sharing those ideas, the more receptive you can be in listening to the questions that people have, the more of an effect you can have. I was at a business dinner the other night, just simple, you know, mozzarella sticks and marinara sauce, and doing more listening than talking as I'm trying to interact with this company. And the VP of this company is as old as I am or older, grandkids, you know, sharing small talk back and forth, just trying to get to know one another. But I do more listening than talking in these kinds of meetings. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, halfway through a steaming hot mozzarella stick, he turns to me and says, "So, Brooks, what's your view of the universe?" I mean, come on. I wanted to say, "What the heck are you talking about? We're talking about plastic and how it fits into an automobile." And all of a sudden you turn to me and ask me what my view of the universe is. Now, I didn't say that, but that's what's going through my mind. Well, having just finished my own mozzarella stick, I, of course, was able to speak as he was moving towards the second half of his. And I was pretty open. I said, we are eternal beings having a mortal experience. And everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So we might as well do it on purpose. No look of shock. No, where the heck did that come from? There was no, hey, that's not what I meant. I was talking about plastic. None of that. All of a sudden, this conversation with four guys, two of whom knew each other, but the rest of us were just interacting with each other for the first evening as we're working into a business arrangement. The whole conversation shifted into a much higher plane. And we talked about that for the next hour. Now, we had to order nachos after that, I'm telling you, because the conversation just went on. And do you know that all four of those men have written me back in my emails commenting about how much they enjoyed that conversation, about how they always wanted to talk about that stuff and never could find anybody to talk about it with, and how energized and awake. One of the guys said, I didn't even sleep all night. I was thinking about all this stuff. That is so amazing. That's what I'm talking about. Share what you know. You are source. And all your thinkings and doings will be rendered utterly insignificant if you are not true to yourself. If you don't share your awareness, because there are others out there. Oh, they appear to be asleep. Oh, believe me. They look fast asleep in their neckties and their starched shirts, but they're not. They're not. They're poking their head up and they're looking around and they know something is up, but no one will talk to them. So talk to them about it. Tell them a couple of the discoveries that you've learned about on this program and watch them come alive. And when they ask you, where did you learn about this? Where did you hear about this? Please tell them, I heard about it on X Squared Radio. We've been on the BBS Radio Network now in our eighth year. This September will be 8 years. And it's had its ups and downs. We've been number one, and we've been in the top 10, and we kind of go up and down and around. And that's because of you, the listener, and maybe because of me, the inept host. But I get the feeling that you're listening, because as I go to the different conferences, whether it's the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles or the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Holland or different conferences around the world, I meet you. I hear you. And you come to me and say, hey, I listen to X Squared Radio. That's really cool. That's really why I am here. We don't make any money at this. We just pay for the airtime. By the way, if you have noticed that your archives are not working anymore, it's probably because your subscription has expired. When I moved to the new server, something happened with my software that I use to manage the subscriptions. And for some reason, it stopped protecting the folder. And so it let all of the archive listeners in for free, for probably about 9 months. Well, I didn't know about it. I just noticed that my listenership was dropping off more and more. More and more people were listening. I was still seeing the couple of terabytes a month going out, but I wasn't seeing the revenue. And so I started to have to come back out of my pocket again to pay for airtime. And so I went back in and I discovered the flaw when we changed servers. The language in the software that manages the code and the language that manage those folders had to be updated. So now your archives are probably not working because you haven't paid in a while. And I need you to go back and look at your subscriptions and think about when they ended. Some of them ended as much as January of 2012, but you still kept listening for free, which is fine. That's fine. We made it. I'm not asking for any back pay. I'm just saying that the archives have stopped working. It is because your subscription has expired. So please find your $20, renew your 1-year subscription, and let's keep up the tradition with X Squared Radio, and by all means, tell a friend about us. BBS Radio is the largest webcast radio network in the United States, possibly in the world. Tons and tons of traffic come here, and it's because of the love and dedication of our producers. Doug spends his entire waking life, 7 days a week, in front of multiple computer screens, making sure that you get a chance to listen to X Squared Radio and all the other fine hosts on Channel 1 and Channel 2. We're part of the BBS Radio Network. We're also part of the Truth Frequency Network. They air also the first couple of hours of X Squared Radio. I am a truth freak, and I love being a part of Chris and Sherry's network over there. Love being a part of their program when they ask me to come on their program. And I love getting your mails, so please keep sending them at bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com. You know where X Squared Radio is. You know where we try to be. We want to be where you want to go. Remember, Earth Explorers, to look for the good in others and help it to grow every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. We need some saving. And I'm amazed, and I said humbled, at how many people are aware. And they are now reclaiming their sovereignty. They're no longer abdicating their own care and feeding to someone else. But sadly, most of our society, freely and without any coercion whatsoever, gives up their freedom to a government who has stopped governing, to a government that has started ruling. We need to reach out to those individuals and let them know that freedom is only a click away. Those of you that read my last book, Alienated Nation, already know what this process is. All they have to do is contact their governor, contact their state senator, not the U.S. senator, but the state senator with your state legislature. Acknowledge that they have written a sovereignty act for that state, which now over 40 states have done, and ask them to act upon it. Ask them to join with the 39 other governors around the country, and let's get this constitutional convention underway, and let's save this republic from the agency government that has taken it over and threatens to enslave us all. I listened to the beautiful words of Rand Paul this last week as he took apart one of the agencies that was passing regulations preventing us from being able to buy incandescent light bulbs, from being able to buy toilets that flush. And I was amazed at his boldness, at his confidence, and his ability to take them apart limb from limb in front of the American public, for those of you that actually saw Rand Paul say these words. It's high time that our elected officials started representing this republic, because that's what it is, Earth Explorers. That's what it should be, and that's what it could be again. But it isn't going to happen from a federal level. Senators, congressmen, I'm sorry, they're not empowered to do anything. The president can use executive orders, can order his secretaries in his cabinet to command the agency government to unilaterally disarm us, get us out of our cars, take our food away from us, take our rights to vote away from us, take our rights to buy products that we want to buy away from us. take our rights to say what we want to say away from us, take our rights to move unfettered around the country away from us. Oh, yes, the agencies are hard at work. Thousands of new regulations every single month that have a direct effect on your life are coming straight from the president, not from Congress, not from you, not from the Senate, straight from the president. It is fascism at its best, but our Constitution still allows for a convention that could be forced by the governors. It could be done in a weekend, and we could re-empower the Supreme Court to take this all apart. We're out of time, and we'll see you next month, first Sunday in March, coming up on Easter, quicker than you can imagine. Go forth, Earth Explorers, affect the universe. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.